Well, good evening, everyone. Thank you for coming this evening. The meeting of the Ways and Means Committee will come to order. There is a quorum. The minutes of the meeting from yesterday, April 25th, are before us. Representative Carlson moves approval of those minutes. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
Before you start, I wanted you and I to talk briefly on the floor about a vehicle. And so will we be folding these three bills in tonight into the vehicle, or will we be doing the folding of all four bills tomorrow?
I thought, Representative Carlson, that we would do the folding tomorrow. I guess my intention under the order tonight is we take up the agriculture finance bill, then lay it over. We then take up state government finance, lay it over. We then take up environment, lay it over. Then we'd adjourn. And then we would come back tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock, this same room. We would take up jobs, lay it over, and then we would take up House File 4099, which is the vehicle bill, and then bring those four other bills into that bill.
And it's not an ambulance.
And it's not an ambulance. No, sir. No, that was yesterday.
Remember, we talked about ambulances.
That was yesterday.
Yeah, I know. Okay.
Very good.
Thank you. Okay. Anyone else have any other questions on procedural issues? Okay. Well, with that, Agriculture Policy Chair Anderson would come forward. I will move that House File 3719 be referred to the General Register, and we have Chair Anderson here with us, a second Chair Anderson here with us, Chair Anderson P. And we do have one... Really, it's an author's amendment, the A7 amendment. And I think what I'll do is I'll move the A7 amendment just to get the bill in the shape that the author desires it. And Chair Anderson, I wonder if you could briefly describe what's in the A7 amendment.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair and members. Pretty much technical. It allows the Department of Ag to use any unused funding from the bioincentive program to continue using that in the future. It allows them to go to a three-year grant rotation on the agri funding, and a technical cleanup that would not allow Second Harvest Heartland to have to provide a match in one of their transportation allowances when they distribute food. And the last of it just provides some definition clarification of the bill, Mr. Chair.
All right. Any discussion of the A7 amendment? No discussion. All in favor of the A7 amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A7 amendment is adopted. Chair Anderson, to the bill. Can you give us a top-level rundown of the bill?
Thanks again, Mr. Chair. Not a big target for the ag finance. A couple of spending items. $30,000 to increase the Farm Advocate Program. That bill was sponsored by Representative Poppy. Also an increase of $200,000 in the Rural Mental Health counseling program, which would actually double at the staff from one to two. So that's a very high need in the ag situation right now, with the situation being low crop prices and commodity prices. There's a real need for that. Maybe the biggest piece in the bill, Mr. Chair, is additional funding requested by the governor, and we see the need for it also. $35 million in bonding for the RFA program. Their funding is running short. There's a big need for that. And so the ask is for $35 million in bonding for the RFA program, Mr. Chair.
All right. Discussion to House File 3719 as amended. Any discussion? Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one other piece that is in the bill, it's not related to finance, but it's related to policy, is the nitrogen rule. So just wanted to make sure that it's also identified that that's an issue. We have a good finance bill, but we're complicated by the policy that's included in this bill.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Anderson, one of the things we talk about in this committee are things that we wish we'd seen in the bill, and we haven't seen in this bill. And the thing I have been thinking about is all those folks whose wells have tested above the health risk limit for nitrogen, and the Department of Ag's testing shows that there are 1,912 of them, or at least at the last count. And normally when Minnesotans have problems that they didn't create, if it's a flood or a tornado, Minnesota has a good history of weighing in and helping folks out.
Go ahead.
Okay. So I am wondering why that isn't included in this particular bill, particularly from the finance side, that we're not helping out those folks whose wells are above the 10 parts per million.
Chair Anderson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, as I mentioned earlier, our target was not very large, and that we chose to use the funding we had available for mental health counseling and things like that, and the nitrogen rule being worked on by the department is going to continue to be worked on, and they're going to do their research. And what Representative Poppe brought up was that in the bill there's a provision that says that would come back, the rulemaking would come back to us for final approval probably next January when session resumes again.
Representative Wiggins.
Okay, but it's not the rulemaking that I'm talking about. It is the normal responsibility that the state takes when citizens are harmed through no fault of their own. And we have examples in the state. If there's a flood, we come in and help. And we do that. And it may not be in my district. It may be in somebody else's district. But we help out. When there's a tornado, we do the same thing. I am proud of Minnesota for doing that. Even though it's never happened in my district, I'm proud to help other areas. But we have a different problem when somebody's drinking water well is contaminated. And through no fault of their own, because when the Department of Ag tests these wells, it makes sure that the wells that they are putting on the list were not contaminated by the owner. I mean, they do a double check, and they make sure that happens. So the question I have is, since this is in the agriculture area, why we are not seeing a proposal to help folks out with clean drinking water.
Representative Fabian.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think a part of this issue that we're talking about here has to do with the Department of Health, and I'm not exactly sure where the dividing lines are there. Maybe staff or somebody can help us out there. But, you know, some of this that Representative Wagenius is talking about may be necessary to go through the Department of Health, which would be in a different bill.
Well, I do think that the Department of Health is the one that is doing the monitoring in this area, not the Department of Agriculture, from what I understand. But Representative Wagenius.
No, actually, it is the Department of Agriculture who is doing the monitoring. So it is clean water money that was given to the Department of Agriculture, and they test for nitrogen. It's voluntary testing. And if they find nitrogen, they test for pesticides. And that is also clean water funding that was given to the Department of Agriculture. So definitely the Department of Agriculture. They're doing the testing. That's why the map that I have for you in the packet is a Department of Agriculture map.
Well, I know that there is a Department of Agriculture map, but actually, and I guess if there is some staff here that knows the answer to this, I'd be curious, because I think it actually is the Department of Health that's been involved in a lot of this from some of the experience that I've had in it. But I don't know, is there a staff person here who can speak to that? Hello there. All right. Welcome to the committee on weight. Mr. Sullivan. And then we'll go to you. Okay.
Mr. Chair and members, I also staff the House Agriculture Finance and Policy Committees. I think the Department of Agriculture, and this place represents them, but I think the Department of Ag has been looking primarily at private drinking water wells, whereas the Department of Health looks at public water supplies.
Okay. Could you state your name for the record and give us your testimony?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Whitney Place. I'm the Legislative Director at the Department of Agriculture. And Mr. Sullivan is correct. The Groundwater Protection Act is under the purview of the Department of Agriculture, and we have authority to test private wells. The Department of Health does so with public wells.
So, Representative Lagunas, we're both right.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lagunas.
Well, Mr. Chair, the wells that I am talking about are the private wells that have been tested by the Department of Agriculture. They have picked out, and you can just look at the map if you haven't seen it. They picked out, and it's in gray, the areas that they believe are the most vulnerable and that have row crops. So I would say that in some respects you're right, that the Department of Health does not offer testing outside of these areas. I think they should be. I mean, I look at our farm is in Douglas County, and it's not in a vulnerable area. But there's no well testing offered by the state or even encouraged by the state. You have to know that you ought to be testing your well each year, and we don't have much of a plan. We test our well, and the last time we tested it, even though we are on non-vulnerable area, it was the first time we saw nitrogen in our water. So, but that was us testing it. But I am going back to the ones that have been tested by the Department of Ag, and this is an agriculture pollutant, and so my question is about the department helping out folks whose private wells have been contaminated by nitrogen, which means there are pesticides in those wells, because the department has actually done some really good science here, and they've found the correlation between nitrogen in wells and pesticides. So if there's a little bit of nitrogen, there's likely a little bit of pesticide. If there's a lot of nitrogen, there's likely a lot of pesticides. And credit to the department for doing that analysis. That was remarkably good work.
Okay, and of course there are many cities that have public wells as well. But you are right, this is certainly a problem in some areas too. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quickly, and again, maybe staff can help me out too, or Ms. Place, but Representative Wagenius says that we're using clean water money for this, but then that would come through clean water legacy. Help me out here. How are those two things blending together? I mean, what does that have to do with the ag bill?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, that's correct. All of our testing in private wells is funded through the Clean Water Fund.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that's something that's coming before this body at some point.
Okay. Chair Anderson, do you have any comments to this?
No, again, we dealt with the spending level we had. It was not a request by the department, and we chose to use the limited funds we had looking in the areas of mental health and this in this non-budget year.
Okay. I have Representative Carlson, then Liebling. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, well, Mr. Chair, and I was just wondering if there was somebody that could quickly explain the map a little bit. I see the red dot means that there was 10 parts per million, and then the shaded dark gray says that townships tested through 2015. And what it doesn't tell me, unless it's somewhere on this chart, how close a well might have been to the 10 parts per million. You know, were there some that were 9 parts per million? This is something I'm not that well-versed in terms of where those cut lines are, why they're where they're at. You know, so I'm not sure if those gray areas then that were tested but with that don't have any of the red dots were at great risk, you know, just below the cut line or just what that means. But I don't want to belabor it. I can find out later if somebody quickly has an answer to that.
To that point, I think Representative Wiginius has an answer.
Yes, if you will look on the chart at the bottom, Representative Carlson, there is a, to the right-hand side, there is a number of wells with over 3 parts per million. And if you go all the way down to the, so it's by county, and if you go all the way down to the bottom, you'll see that there are 4,321 wells that test over 3. Actually, the department has a lot more numbers than this. They can show you over 7 and whatever. And then if you look over to the then there's the number of wells over 10, and that's 1,912.
Yeah, and Mr.
Representative Carlson,
what I noticed that, and what I was looking at, Mr. Chairman, was that mid-range there was from 3 to 10. Is the way I was interpreting that. But it really doesn't tell how close some of those might be to 10, is what I was referencing. Maybe I wasn't clear with the question. You know, how many of those might be at 9 or 8?
I think the department would have that.
Yeah, and that's probably getting into the weeds for right now. But that's helpful. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if Representative Anderson can help me with this or staff, but thinking about the mental health provision in the bill, I thought it's a little, maybe a little unusual to carry mental health money in an ag bill, and so I was looking in the bill to try to find the language that goes along with that, and I'm not locating that because I was kind of curious about that provision, and I mean, I think I'm familiar with what problem is trying to be solved, they're trying to solve here. But so I have kind of two questions. One is, where is the language? And then, you know, kind of the, is this a kind of a new thing to carry mental health money in an ag bill? Or is this something that's kind of happened before when farmers have particular health issues? Or, you know, exactly how are we, how is it that we're doing mental health in the ag bill? Just curious. I'm not criticizing it. I'm just really curious about it.
Ms. Place?
Mr. Chair, I'm Representative Liebling. In our historic agriculture budget, we have a $113,000 pass-through that goes to the Minnesota State System to fund a position focused on rural mental health. So that's one position focused on the entire state. This additional funding for a second position was actually a request from Governor Dayton, and we worked really closely with the Agriculture Finance Committee to get it funded as well.
Uh-huh.
And Representative Liebling, it is page 10, line 19.
Ah, thank you, Mr. Chair. That's what I'm looking for. And okay, I see. Thank you very much. And as I say, I'm not criticizing it. I'm just curious about it because, you know, I'm used to seeing this in the Health and Human Services bill. Thank you.
Okay, other discussion to the bill. Chair Anderson, any closing comments?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's been a long day, and this is a good bill, and I would encourage your support of the Ag Finance Bill.
All right, at this time, then, I'm going to temporarily lay over House File 3719 as amended. Next will be the State Government Finance Bill. And Chair Anderson, yes. Two Chair Andersons in a row. How lucky is that? Chair Anderson S. moves that House File 4016 be referred to the General Register. And Chair Anderson, I know that there are some amendments. Should we take those first?
Yes, please.
Okay. Members, I'll move the A-16 amendment. What the A-16 amendment is, as you'll recall in the budget targets. We take the surplus $75 million that was originally part of roughly $300 million taken from the budget reserve last year for the premium subsidy program. There's $75 million in that program left unspent. And so in our budget we passed, we put that into the budget reserve. And so this amendment does that, and I'd appreciate your support. Any questions on the A-16 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of the A-16 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion prevails. The A-16 amendment is adopted. Representative Anderson, what amendment would you like to take next?
A-13, Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson moves the A-15 amendment. And if you could...
A-13.
A-13 amendment, excuse me. Representative Anderson moves the A-13 amendment, if you could describe the amendment.
Sure, or I should say, yeah, sure, you betcha, right, since we've got the Anderson plan here. Mr. Chair, this is some technical corrections that we needed to make after getting out of committee. The first portion is kind of giving ourselves some flexibility about the DVS fund. If that changes, we want to make sure that it applies to not just that existing fund, but any funds that would happen later on. That's on line 1.2 and 1.3. Then going on the rest of the piece is we had some requests from the Department of DHS. They wanted us to make some changes, and so we worked with them to get the correct language. And so that's dealing with lines 4 through 7. And then the final portion is making some adjustments on the prepayment of bonds related to the stadium. And that's the amendment.
All right. Any discussion to the A-13 amendment? Seeing no discussion, all in favor of the A-13 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The A-13 amendment is adopted. And who has the A-14 or 15 amendment? Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I'll move the A-14 amendment.
Representative Marquardt moves the A-14 amendment. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much. This amendment stems, it actually was a bill I introduced from last year with some modifications, but stems back to a law we passed in the 2015 special session dealing with the county audit statute. And a county has to go out and get a financial audit every year. And before it was mainly done through the state auditor's office. The bill passed in 2015 on a bipartisan basis said that they could go either with the state auditor's office or with their own CPA outside contracted one. The state auditor sued three counties over this, saying that it was unconstitutional, the law. And the three counties were Becker, which I represent, Wright, and Ramsey County, those three counties. So this went to district court, which the counties prevailed, then went to the the Minnesota Court of Appeals, which the three counties prevailed, and then just recently, within the last couple of weeks, the Minnesota Supreme Court again ruled in favor of these counties, saying that, in fact, this law did not transfer any of the core services of the county, of the state auditor away, because that auditor still had control over the standard and how these were conducted. At any rate, Ramsey County did their attorney work in-house, so they're not in this bill, and that's the reason they're not. But Wright County and Becker County contracted with one attorney, and those costs came in now at almost $140,000. So what this would do is split that, because it was split out to the counties, and we have documentation for that. Also, I will say that the Minnesota County's Intergovernmental Trust, that's their insurance for the counties, said that this type of a lawsuit is not covered, and so they could not collect through that. So these were costs that were incurred by these counties through no fault of their own. They were unexpected costs, and primarily incurred because of the actions of the state auditor. And so these funds come from the state auditor. However, They cannot come from anything that would reduce operations or services related to public pensions. So that's the bill, and would look for the committee support.
Representative Erdahl, discussion to the A14 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And as one who does represent a portion of Wright County, I certainly have been made aware of this problem and support the words of Representative Marquardt, who explained very well what the situation is and the need for remedy.
Other discussion of the A14 amendment. Chair Anderson.
I just encourage members to support the amendment.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I, too, would support the amendment. I just think it's unfortunate that there's not a recourse that the county auditor's budget should be charged for this unnecessary litigation.
Other discussion?
That's what I said, or state auditor, sorry.
All right, seeing no further discussion, all in favor of the A14 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion prevails. The A14 amendment is adopted. And who has the A15 amendment?
Mr. Chair, that would be mine.
Representative Poppy moves the A15 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is an amendment due to a situation in the for the city of Austin. The city of Austin has a full-time fire department with a paid on-call system, so it's a combined fire department. And for many years, they have been able to put money into their relief fund, but they were notified 2 years ago in 2016 that in 2013, the law was changed, and they had been continuing to do things the way they had always done them. And then when it was changed, they actually weren't notified of that, or they don't believe that they were notified of that. So they have had some they did receive a letter, an email from the state auditor's office regarding that, which indicated that their practice of retaining a portion of the annual fire state aid distribution needed to change. And so until that repeal, they were allowed to use the state fire aid differently, but now due to the change in law, they weren't able to do it the same way. So we have a bill in that, and we've been working on this for 2 years, and Chair Anderson is well aware of that. We have a bill in to the Pension Commission, which would actually relieve them of the repayment for and offer forgiveness for the years 2013, 2014, 2015, and 2016, but up to 2015. And what they would like is they've had to forfeit the 2016 fire state aid, so that's what this is, a repayment of the 2016 state aid. Hopefully we'll have a pension bill this year so that they won't need to give back the money for 2017 and kind of get this fix going for the future years. So it really is something that goes back a couple of years, but it caught up with them. And when they had to forfeit the state aid, it was just over $129,000 that was forfeited, and they're trying to recoup that to make it whole for the city. So I'm just doing my due diligence to represent the city of Austin and in this situation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Chair Anderson, do you have a position on this amendment?
I would encourage members to support this amendment.
Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I hope we all can support Representative Poppy on this. This was something that needs to be taken care of, and I hope we can all support it.
Other discussion to the A15 amendment. Seeing no further discussion, all in favor of the A15 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The A15 amendment is adopted. I do not see any other amendments. Chair Anderson, could you present your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Because this is the Ways and Means Committee, I will limit my comments to the financial portions of the bill. Probably the biggest component of this legislation is that we use money from the stadium reserve to fund three veteran homes across the state of Minnesota, one in Preston, one in Bemidji, and one in Montevideo. We take $26 million from the stadium reserve to fund those three homes. In addition to that, we take another $4 million, roughly, to fund the governor's sexual harassment office for state employees. Members, in your packets, you do have an explanation that nonpartisan staff, Cynthia Templin, prepared for the Ways and Means Committee earlier this session that just explains how the stadium funding works. And since Representative Carlson had questions about this just the other day, I just wanted to go through a couple of the highlights from this. The stadium reserve is what is left over after we pay the state debt for the stadium. And so what this bill does is it takes what we expect as excess funds for fiscal year 19 and dedicate it towards the veterans' homes and also then to the governor's sexual harassment office. On top of this, I want to kind of direct you to look at both page 4, but then also on page 15, where you can see the prediction of the revenue that will be available to us into the tails beyond this. But my bill only deals with fiscal year 19. So just want to point out those two pieces. As for the other financial components of the legislation, my target, my budget target for the bill was a negative $7 million. So we went to several different areas to look at how we can make government more accountable and streamline. So a couple of things that we do in here, we do have a reduction to the Attorney General's office of $1 million. We have a reduction to the Minnesota Department of Human Rights office as well. For the Minnesota Department of Revenue, we reduce their operating budget to what is their current budget. So they just could keep going with their fiscal year 18 budget. That will be their fiscal year 19 budget as well. I think those are kind of the big ones that I want to highlight. Other things, areas that we did prioritize, though, as far as funding, we do have funding available for a healthy eating grant. This is to utilize Minnesota-grown products and getting them to families that don't have access to good produce. We also highlight Everybody Wins reading program that helps children be prepared to learn and have that skill. And then we also make sure that students have access and teachers have access to economic education so that they are more prepared in helping students manage their finances. So those are kind of the major priorities that are part of the legislation. I didn't go through the entire budget piece, but I wanted to be respectful of everybody's time since it has been a long day. So I stand for any questions, Mr. Chair.
We'll take some questions, but we do have a number of people that want to testify, too. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and Representative Anderson. If this is some other place, and I've missed it, I apologize, but how much is given to each of the three veterans homes? Is that divided up equally, or are there different amounts?
Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Erdahl, it is $10 million to Preston, $10 million to Bemidji, and $6 million to Montevideo. Those are the amounts communities have given to our committee as what they need for their veterans' homes.
All right, thank you.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you.
Representative Hausman.
I can wait till after the testimony if you...
That's fine.
I could just perhaps follow up, though, on the veterans' home thing.
If you wish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What concerns me about that is that this becomes sort of false hope for those communities, that they think if we're providing this, that these homes are going to happen. But, in fact, they have to receive federal money, and we know, because we've checked, there isn't sufficient federal money, and these homes rank so low that they simply are not going to be getting it in the foreseeable future. And so, you know, the fear is we send a message to these communities that this is actually going to happen, and I wish we could be sort of clear about what the possibilities are.
I have Representative Detmer, then Davids. Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Anderson, for bringing this forward, including the three veterans' homes in the state government finance bill. These communities have been working on this. I know a couple of communities have been working on it for over 10 years. So between the three communities, we're looking at over 20 years that we've been working on getting more beds here in Minnesota. And I know the federal government is putting more money into these projects, and until we get on their priority list, we don't have a chance of bringing these homes to Minnesota. Right now, we have 824 beds in Minnesota. The federal government now says, Minnesota, you can have 1,058 beds. By building these three homes of about 72 beds each, we would increase our number of beds to about 216 beds. That would bring us up to 1,040 beds. We're still under the federal limits. So these communities have already raised, they've got the land, they've already raised money, and we need to do our best, our diligent best to go forward with it. And it'd be nice to just write out a check and build them ourselves. But the federal government will provide 65% of the building cost. Our state will have to provide 35% of the building cost. And, of course, then we have to supply the operational cost. But we have the need here in Minnesota. There's waiting lists for, especially in the outlying area like Bemidji, Montevideo, and Preston. There's no, some of these people have to drive, up in Bemidji, they have to drive 4 hours to get to the nearest one. And then the families that want to visit their veterans. Right now, most of the veterans in our five veterans homes, which include Minneapolis, Laverne, Hastings, Fergus Falls, and Silver Bay, most of them are World War II veterans and Korean War veterans. And I would say those World War II veterans, the young ones are in their mid-90s. That generation is going to be gone. We're going to be seeing Vietnam War veterans now entering our veterans' homes. So as I mentioned before in another committee, I said the young veterans right now are watching Minnesota, how we are treating our veterans that are in our veterans' homes now. This is their last mission. When they leave the veterans' home, it will be draped in a flag. So we need to do our best to take care of our veterans, and we really have a need here in Minnesota. Thank you, Chair Anderson.
Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I am very fortunate to be able to serve on the Veterans Division, and we had some joint meetings with the Senate, and after one of them, I felt kind of like Representative Hausman. I was kind of down, and I don't want to provide anybody false hope, because we were down on the list, and I wasn't feeling too good about that, so I started digging into it quite a bit deeper. And if you look at the list, and yes, the feds are putting more money into this, but if you look at the list, and I talked to quite a few folks in the veterans community, if the state does this, and I applaud Chair Anderson for what she has done here and her committee has done, if we do this and we have state funding to back it up, we skyrocket up the list. Because a lot of the folks on the list, a lot of the areas on the list, don't have the state backing. They made it to the list, but they don't have the state backing. What we need is the state backing. We need it now. Because if this gets funded now, we're still about 5 years out before this gets done. This is a lengthy process dealing with the federal government. But we make this commitment, and we're not on the bottom of the list. We skyrocket towards the top. Because, like I said, a lot of the veterans' home proposals that are on that list don't have the state backing they have to have. So coming out of the meeting feeling like Representative Hausman, after further study, I went right up the list with the homes. Because if we get this done, we have a very, very good shot at doing this sooner rather than later. So this is for real. I'm not known for blowing blue smoke up people's noses. That's not what I do. And I had the same feelings that Representative Hausman had. And, man, I felt a lot better, or woman. I felt a lot better after having talked to some folks in the VA that's how it works. I didn't know how it worked. But I do know that if we pass Chair Anderson's bill and the funding's there, we have a real shot real soon to get these funded, get these built where they're needed. And so thank you, Chair Anderson, for your efforts on this issue.
Mr. Chair.
Chair Anderson.
Mr. Chair, too, I just wanted to share this with Representative Hausman, too. This is dated from April 18th. that Minnesota should expect to get $150 million from the feds if we're funding in next year, and there will probably be another $100 million in projects carried over to the next biennium as well. So we're looking at some significant investment from the feds, and this is it's kind of like we hit the right moment. And so I think if we can do this, we will be right in stride where we need to be.
All right, thank you. At this time, there are a number of people who wish to testify on the bill, and I think we should take testimony, and then there may be questions for the testifiers, and we can go back to other discussion on the bill. Just so people know the order of testimony for this bill, I'm going to call up Secretary of State Simon first, and then Commissioners Lindsay, Ho, Mossman, and Peterson in that order. So, Secretary of State Simon, if you could come forward. Representative Hornstein? Carlson.
Well, I think, well, either one, we both had her end up.
Oh, okay.
He was first.
All right, Representative Carlson.
Must be my senior.
Why? I heard your voice, and then I looked over and I saw Representative Hornstein's hand, and I was like,
we have an understanding in taxes about seniority and who gets to get the donut first when they're being dispersed.
All right, Representative
but,
Carlson.
At any rate, now I've lost track of what my question. Oh, in terms of the testimony, will MMD, Commissioner France, is he on the list?
He's not on the list, and I don't believe he had requested to testify.
Because I talked to him this morning, and he indicated that he would like to testify, and I don't, if he's not prepared to, I...
Well, he says he'd love to, I heard him say, so we'll put him on the list.
Okay, well, that's what I was going to request, because it was my understanding this morning that he was planning on being here. Yeah, very good, thank you.
Okay, yeah, I'm sorry. I guess we didn't, for whatever reason, we didn't have you on the list. But we're glad to put you on the list now. Representative Hornstein.
And thank you. And on the topic of testifiers, I understand there's some parents that are interested in dismissal disparities. Maybe we could hear from one of them at least. I know you've been somewhat flexible on people from the community testifying the other day with Representative Dean, so if we could have someone speak briefly on that issue. I know they're in the audience. So,
well, and, you know, we do take testimony, but I guess we have a lot of other people request to testify. I think, let me see, first of all, what some of the other commissioners say, because I think that Commissioner Lindsay in particular may be talking about that same issue. Just in the interest of time, being it's late and such, let me see how we're doing. Let me start off with Secretary of State Simon. Welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for the opportunity. I know that you've had a long day. Your time is valuable, so I don't want to take up too much of it. I'm here to testify in favor of a portion of the bill of this bill with an asterisk, I would say. The portion is Article 1, Section 4 on page 3, and I want to thank Chair Anderson for putting this in the bill. She had a tough job, and she put this in the bill. I want to thank two members who are not on this committee, Representatives Nash and Chair O'Driscoll, for really helping out with this provision and related provisions as well. So here's what's going on, explain this. So our office had been working with Senator Klobuchar and others in Washington and other secretaries of state to get some federal funding for election security, cybersecurity in particular. I don't need to tell all of you. That's ripped from the headlines. There's bipartisan agreement that that's a priority, and then it costs money. But we didn't know, and even our congressional district didn't know, how quickly that money would come through. About 4 weeks ago, to everyone's surprise, when Congress passed its $1.3 trillion, with a T, trillion-dollar supplemental funding bill, there was a provision for $380 million slipped in there for state security, election security, with an emphasis on cybersecurity. Minnesota's share of that is $6.6 million. It requires a 5% match, so roughly $330,000. We have 5 years to spend the $6.6 million in this state, and we have 2 years to come up with the match. And so our first response to that was to get together with our partners in elections administration, the counties, the cities, and the townships. And we wanted to discuss what our plan would be for you to spend that money. In most states, it's a simple pipeline right from the federal government right to offices of Secretary of State. Not so in Minnesota. In Minnesota and a handful of other states, there's an extra step involved. So we don't just get the money. you in the legislature have to give us the money from the Help America Vote Act account, an existing HAVA account. Mr. Chair, I know you're familiar with it from when HAVA was passed in 2002, and Minnesota has had that account since then. So the money goes into that account, but no one can touch it unless you say so. And so talking with our the other stakeholders, we agreed that the top priority was to modernize and secure the SVRS, the Statewide Voter Registration System, which is the database that our office runs, and that what we would do in terms of the rest of the money is spend the interim working with legislators and staff from both chambers and both parties, with counties, with townships, with cities, to come up with a blueprint or a plan for your review in January. So we're not spending all the money in one place. So what Chair Anderson put in her bill, and we're grateful for it, is the $1.5 million. I think it's $1,534,000 to be precise. And then the match, we got some good news on last week. Our thinking in our office was, okay, the state owes $330,000 sometime in the next 2 years. And we wondered whether there was some way we could get an offset or a credit for money that we have already spent on cybersecurity matters. So we approached them, and to our delight, we got an answer back in writing that, yes, they're willing to wipe away $110,000 or a third of that burden. So it's kind of like found money. So now instead of the state owing $330,000, the state owns $220,000. And Chair Anderson has put that in her bill, which is great, and we're very happy about that. Because we want to get going on this project and do as much of it as we can before the 2018 election, for all the obvious reasons that everyone agrees on, here's the only asterisk. I support it, but let me put this, diplomatically. The fate of this bill is uncertain. And so if for whatever reason this provision or this bill hits a snag between now or the end of the session, I just wanted to make members aware of the issue so that we might find a creative way, and we've been thinking about that, for at least the appropriation of the $1.5 million. And I want to just clarify again, this comes out of no one's target because it's not state or general fund money. This is just language, basically policy language, that would allow us access to this on behalf of the counties, cities, and townships. And so, again, it wouldn't cost any money. There would be no fiscal note to that. The match there would be, and that would be a little bit more challenging. But, again, I just want to thank members who were involved in this, principally the two that I mentioned who aren't on this committee, but Chair Anderson as well, and just plant the seed that this is an important, very important priority for people nationwide. And we just want to find a way to get this done. It's in the bill now, and we're grateful for that. We just want to make sure that it stays alive no matter what. So thank you very much, members. Appreciate your time and attention.
Any questions for Secretary of State Simon? Well, thank you, Secretary of State Simon. Good to see you again.
Thank you.
Next, we have Commissioner Lindsay. Commissioner Lindsay, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today about the Department of Human Rights and the potential proposal that's in the omnibus bill concerning a 30% cut to the Department of Human Rights. 50 years ago, Republican Governor Harold Levander, in his inauguration speech, asked the legislature to lead the nation on securing human rights for all, and he asked for the creation of the Department of Human Rights. And in his speech, he said the following: we need people who want to follow the commandment, love one another, because our most critical problems are really people problems. We're going to have to do more to try to understand people. How do we encourage society to accept the former convict? How do we motivate underprivileged children? How do we create true harmony among the races? How do we assure our senior citizens of a meaningful life? The problem of a mature Minnesota reaches beyond our towns, counties, and districts. They are problems for all of us. There is no clear-cut single answer to all of these problems. The issues are complex and elusive. In a word, however, I'm asking Minnesota to lead. If we in Minnesota can't create true racial harmony, We should ask no other state to do it. Those words were true 50 years ago. They are true today. The cuts to the Department of Human Rights take us a step backwards. The governor has been clear that in his statement to the legislature that he will veto any budget cut to any of his agencies, and especially in a time frame in which we have a surplus of over $320 million. One has to ask the question of why there would be a cut to the Department of Human Rights. This morning I started with a meeting with the Minnesota Employers Fair Chance Hiring Group, Twin Cities Rise, Greater MSB, several corporations in town, international groups, large organizations like the Koch brothers as well, sponsored this effort to try and bridge the divide concerning individuals who need a second chance. More than 150 employers were there for the morning session. For the lunch session, we had more than 100 individual providers and organizations that came. This is the type of work that the department seeks to do. We seek to get into that space and provide guidance to help bridge divides that prevent people from realizing their true potential. This is an important time for us. There is significant demographic change which is occurring. In less than 15 years, one in five Minnesotans will be over the age of 65. No one who is listening to me now in this room by 2030 will ever know a Minnesota where there isn't one in five Minnesotans over the age of 65 for the rest of their life. Children that are in kindergarten will never know a Minnesota where one in five individuals weren't over the age of 65. That portends a huge challenge for us to maximize the talent and the development of those children. We are also getting more diverse as it relates to race and ethnicity. In the Twin Cities region by 2035, more than 40% of the individuals will identify as a person of color. We need to be able to bridge the divide as it relates to age. We need to bridge the divide as it relates to race. We need more collaboration, more partnership. The department seeks to do that in its work. So I ask you, not because the governor is going to veto any potential bill that comes to him with a cut to the department, I ask you to assume the leadership that Governor Lavander set forth 50 years ago for us to create and lead on human rights. This is important work. Let us be the North Star continuing going forward.
Okay, questions for Mr. Lindsay. And I think maybe what I'd like to start with, Commissioner, if I can, is I know there are other people here who wanted to testify and bring up this issue of disparities of suspensions and dismissals in school districts, and I know your department has been involved with us with that. You know, we have one additional commissioner, Commissioner Clyburn, that I guess I hadn't listed before that had also requested to speak, and so we have five other testifiers for this bill in addition to yourself, and then another bill beyond this. And so I think given that Chair Anderson previously took testimony from some people on this topic in her committee, I think I'd like to just have you speak of it, and then we won't take other testimony given the late hour that we're at right now. But could you speak to that issue, Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, I just want to get clarity. To speak to the issue of disparities in general or talking about suspensions and expulsions?
I guess I would say talking about suspensions and expulsions because I think that your department's been involved in some of those actions or bringing actions with a number of school districts or at least bringing questions to a number of school districts, and people here have questions about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Ed Allies is in the audience, and they have several individuals who have signed up and expressed an interest to testify. In essence, I think what they and then other parents around the state would tell you is that they feel from time to time that their children are being treated differently when school officials make decisions concerning who to suspend. The government accounting office at the federal level, in examining the decisions, more than 96,000 schools throughout the United States, has made similar findings in that children of color are being treated differently when suspension decisions are being made by school officials. When we take a look at the data, and all school districts are responsible for submitting their data to the Department of Education and to a system called the Discipline Incident Reporting System, what we find is substantial disparities for Native American students and African American students. In the United States today, the difference as it relates to disparities for African American students to white students concerning suspensions is 3.5 to 1. In Minnesota, however, it is 8 times to 1. When we take a look at the disparities for Native American children across the country, we find devastating disparities at 5 to 1. But somehow in the state of Minnesota, we have doubled down on those disparities, and they're 10 to 1. So for the department, we did not stop there in just looking at the numbers of students that are being suspended. We sat down with the school districts and asked them about their process. We asked them about the training that they provided. We asked them how they interacted with parents. And what we found is that there was a lack of general oversight. There was inconsistency as it relates to training. There was inconsistency as it relates to data collection. One of the things that you can do as a school when you identify a kid for suspension is you can identify in one of 29 categories. One of those categories is other. So when we looked at some of the school districts, and that's not for all, but an appreciable number of them, some of them were identifying more than 100 of their suspensions year after year after year in the category of other. And there was no process by which they were trying to seek to analyze and understand why so many of their suspensions were being designated as other. That suggested to us that it was really intentional for schools to pay more attention to how they were going about the process of suspending students. Now, I know that there has been some questions raised. Appreciate the questions from Representative Anderson, so let me be clear on this. We are not saying that there should be a moratorium on suspension, nor are we saying that there is only one way in which suspensions or corrective action strategies should be meted out by school districts. Without getting too deep into the woods as relates to strategies or plans or approaches by schools, I will just mention three just to give examples. Positive behavior intervention supports, innocent classroom, and restorative justice. So within those frameworks, there could be schools that might be using restorative justice. There might be another school that's using innocent classroom. The department is not dictating to schools that you must use innocent classroom over PBIS. That's a decision that still resides with the school district. But what we are asking for is that they implement their strategy with great fidelity. It is not something which you just simply identify and don't actually fulfill it faithfully. What we're asking for is faithful implementation. And I don't think that's too much for parents to not be involved in that conversation with their local school districts to make sure that that happens.
Thank you, Commissioner. Questions for Commissioner Lindsay. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your work on this dismissal disparities and so many other issues. My question is, how will this cut, it's a 30% cut, you said. First of all, how will it affect your work on this particular issue, and then overall, how will it impact your mission?
Commissioner Lindsay.
Mr. Chair, representative, members of the committee, it would be significant. It would be devastating to the department. A 30% cut will result in 18 individuals losing their positions within the department. That means the department would have fewer individuals than it did in 2011 when I started. Since I have started as commissioner, the legislature has given additional statutory responsibilities to the department, such as monitoring equal pay to ensure that women are paid fairly to men, ensuring second chance opportunities are given to individuals who are convicted, again, hearkening back to Governor LeBlanc's call about taking care of individuals who have been formerly incarcerated. We would not be able to effectively do the ban the box work. We've also been given the responsibility to ensure and encourage emerging entrepreneurs serving on the board with DEED. We also have been asked to partner with the Department of Education to address school bullying. So all four of those things have been added, and we would have fewer individuals. During the time that I have been commissioner, we have increased the number of audits, which we have done to seek to increase career pathways and employment opportunities. Most people know of this work because of our work in increasing workforce participation goals in construction. 2012, the actual participation rate for people of color was less than 11% in construction on the projects which we monitored. 2016, it had increased to 28%. For women working on the state capitol, we achieved about 18% of participation. Women, when we set out the goal in 2012, they were achieving about 3.5%. When we adjusted the workforce goal for women in 2017, it had increased to 9%. Those numbers are low for women, but they're moving in the right direction.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner, thank you. I'm coming into this issue new. I haven't been on the other committees where this has been discussed, and I'm actually a little puzzled. I mean, it's interesting to hear, and I know this issue about suspensions is a very serious one. It is in my community in Rochester, and it's a serious issue. And then we're talking about that, and then we're talking about a 30% proposed cut to your department. And I gather there must be a link between those two, and this maybe is a question more for Representative Anderson, but Representative Anderson, you started out presenting the bill saying that this was about some agencies being more accountable and streamlined. And I guess by streamlined, you just mean smaller, given that there's a 30% cut to this agency. And I would really like to hear your explanation, other than just the fact that you want to save money and you're just going to put it in there. I mean, this is really, really troubling, because I think that every Minnesotan who's honest about this has to realize that we have serious problems with equity in this state. And those problems are holding us back now, and they're going to hold us back more in the future if we don't get our arms around them. A lot of this just due to the demographic change that the commissioner was talking about. And I hear about this all over the place. We need workforce. We need people to be in the workforce. We need to make sure that everybody is kind of working and functioning at the top of their game. And where we have huge disparities in across a lot of different dimensions in the area I work in, health, we have a lot of health disparities. We have educational disparities. We have economic disparities. We have employment disparities. It seems to me that we need a more robust Department of Human Rights than we do than cutting it a third. I just don't get it. Maybe you can explain that to me.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Liebling, as part of the State Government Finance Committee, we've been reviewing this not just this year but for several years, looking at the Minnesota Department of Human Rights budget. And when we heard or learned that the department had initiated on their own without any complaint filed to do this work, it caused us to puzzle of why are they spending their resources on something that had no complaint for this work when they have other responsibilities as part of their budget. And so then we ask the question, well, how much are you dedicating of your resources towards this project? And we got no answer from the department. And when we're putting together a budget and you're asking an agency to provide you with the financial data that we need and to help us put together the budget, it makes it really hard when that agency refuses to respond to those questions.
Well, Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know about what formal complaint there might have been, but I must tell you that in my community, there are a lot of people complaining. So this is a really real issue. I don't think the commissioner made it up. I can just tell you that from my own community. So, you know, this is really concerning, because Representative Anderson, this whole issue, the space that he works in, is critical to the state. This isn't about him. This is about Minnesotans and what they expect of us. So, I mean, this is really, I think this is a thumb in the eye of a lot of people in this state, and not just the man sitting next to you and not just the governor, but a lot of people. And I don't think it's going to be viewed, with very warm feelings by lots and lots of people, even if it does get vetoed and doesn't happen. I'm just really disappointed in that, Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair.
Chair Anderson.
And Representative Liebling, I'm really disappointed when an agency that I have purview over refuses to provide the financial data that the committee requests. I think that makes it really challenging for us as a committee to do our job.
All right. I have Representatives Loon, Murphy, Garofalo, and Drazkowski. And I, Commissioner, I guess if you want to speak at some point, I guess let me know.
Mr. Chair, if I could, just on a point concerning complaints, I believe when I was before Chair Anderson's committee, I did indicate to her that there was no one who had sworn out an administrative charge, but I had heard complaints from parents throughout the state concerning suspensions, and I think I even testified here earlier, is that this has been a concern which has been brought to my attention by parents within the state. One other thing I should say, it is clear that the commissioner can bring administrative charges on behalf of the state, and I have done so in the past, and I'll give a concrete example of that. There was a high school in which a senior official was engaged in sexual harassment and was engaging in predatory behavior of female students in the school. I didn't feel that it was appropriate to have a student sign their name and have their name identified in that charge, and therefore I brought a commissioner's charge on behalf of several female students in that high school. So it is not unprecedented for the commissioner to take such action.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. I appreciate your testimony, and I have not had a chance to have a face-to-face discussion. I apologize if some of my questions or maybe things you responded to in state government finance, I don't serve on that committee. But obviously whatever happens in our schools is of great interest to me as of chair of the Education Finance Committee. And I think the issues that you bring up are ones that we have talked about at some length in our committee. And we have funded or place money or for schools to incorporate alternative behavioral strategies like PBIS that you mentioned and other things to try to address more positive ways of redirecting student behavior and getting better outcomes for students. And I think those are all really important initiatives. And we've had a discipline working group as well that has tried to look at some of these issues. But you know, some concerns have been raised about this process, and I guess I've been a little surprised that the Department of Education has not really been in contact with me about their involvement with this process. Obviously, they work with schools on a daily basis, and so has your office utilized the Department of Education or their expertise? What has been your involvement or their involvement in this process of whether it's those 43 schools that initially got communicated to by your office or others?
Commissioner Lindsay.
Mr. Chair, Representative, and members of the committee, in all aspects in which we initiate some type of open file or investigation, we utilize experts within that respective area. So in this one, that would not have been uncommon for us to reach out to the Department of Education and ask for information to help guide us within our investigation. That does not mean that there is a delegation of our responsibility to do investigations under the Act, but they are a resource that we might use. So to that extent, we have had conversations with the Department of Education concerning corrective action strategies such as PBIS. We have had conversations concerning DERS to make sure that we understand the Discipline Incident Reporting System, and I'll give you a concrete example of that. So within DERS, it identifies for schools to identify the more serious physical offense as the reason for suspension. So if I were to, as a principal, suspend a student for fighting and then for verbal abuse, I wouldn't designate it as both of those within the DERS system. I would identify it as fighting. And we wanted to make sure that that was clear and how that was communicated to schools.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for that. And so it sounds like you may have consulted with the Department of Education, but you are sort of conducting this investigation or these actions on your own and maybe at times doing some coordinating activities with the Department of Education?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I want to be clear on this, that the initiation of the investigation belongs to the Department of Human Rights. To the extent that we consult or get information from the Department of Education, this is not a joint effort between the two of us. And I think that that's important. It is an effort by the Department of Human Rights.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. So then within your department, obviously, again, you're dealing with, you know, young children in school districts and that. You have then experts or people with experience within your department working on this investigation that is knowledgeable about discipline strategies and different, I'll just refer to them as curriculum or programs for addressing discipline issues with students because they, you know, schools have to deal with this on a daily basis. So do you have experts within your department in this area?
Okay, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we believe that we have adequate resources to be able to ascertain whether they're implementing it correctly. So from that vantage point, yes. But I want to go back to a point. We're not in a position, nor would we feel it appropriate, to dictate to the school district that they'd have to use a particular strategy. That is a local control issue for the school district to implement. To that extent, there are a wide variety of areas in which we investigate, and we are seeking to determine whether there is a differentiation and disparate treatment between people and how programs, policies are being implemented. That does not necessarily mean that we have to be subject matter experts to the same degree of which we are investigating a group. So, for example, if I were to investigate a hospital concerning its operations, concerning whether they were providing similar care to individuals who are deaf and hard of hearing when they're communicating about emergency procedures, I don't have to necessarily know all about the respective emergency procedures to know if there's a differentiation in treatment. So when we had the finding against Fairview that they were providing inconsistent treatment or inconsistent translators and inconsistent information to deaf and hard of hearing individuals, I felt that that was appropriate for us to make that determination.
Thank you. I'm sorry, just a couple of other questions, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your indulgence. Commissioner, then, so you're not advocating any particular model policy for schools. Are you offering them a range of particular policies you'll hope they'll adopt or some guidance on discouraging them from choosing a method or methods over others in terms of trying to address the disparities that you've identified?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, and members of the committee, I believe what you're asking is, are we saying that there is one way in which for a school district to be successful? And the answer is no. And I'll use an example concerning the space that we provide advice and we regulate the activity of state contractors. There are many ways for you to create a culture of diversity and inclusion for women. We are not saying that there is only one way in which to do that. Just was downstairs testifying concerning sexual harassment. So to the extent that employers have a sexual harassment policy, there can be many different ways in which that can be written. Yes, we want to make sure there's a baseline for that, but how employers do that, that is up to them. How do they create a culture that women are seen, heard, and are in a position to be their full self at their place of employment and also be in position for promotion? Again, there are many ways in which that can be done. The department can provide some guidance to respective employers, but it's not dictating that there's only one way in which that for that to be occurring.
Representative Loon.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, well, thank you. I'm glad to hear that because, again, I think our approach generally within the Education Committee on many things that we initiate with schools is to offer them some latitude and locally to try to determine these decisions because oftentimes when we try to create one particular way or model, it doesn't work for every school, and we sure hear about it. And so I'm glad and hope that that will be the case with that, the schools will still feel free to to try things. I talk with schools on a daily basis, and I know many of them are really working to how do they address, again, in a positive way, behavior issues in children. How do we help redirect? How do we try to make sure then that that doesn't happen again, and everybody goes off in the right way and on to be successful? We had the education finance omnibus bill on the floor this afternoon, and there are some discipline policies in there, some coming from the governor, and we did make a few tweaks. But one of the things I have concerns about, and the reason I ask about policies, is there's a lot of discussion about not removing students from the classroom when they're disruptive, and basically trying to reinforce that we want the students to be in the classroom. And yes, generally we do, but when issues arise where a student is very disruptive, whether it's a physical threat to other students in there or just one where the teacher cannot continue to present the lesson or the learning going on, if there is an effort to try to remove the authority or the discretion of the teacher to say maybe this student needs to go have a conversation with someone else in the building right now so I can continue with my lesson, I am concerned about efforts to curtail that, because you have probably 20-some other students in that classroom who also have a right to continue learning and that. And so that is a balance that schools have to address, and it's a difficult one. I'll grant you that. And I think schools have a tough job on some of these issues. But I didn't know if you had a particular point of view on that, because, it's one where I really want to respect the authority of teachers who also have a tough job. And I'm not advocating for suspension or removal of the school from these students, but maybe students just need time to talk out whatever issues are troubling them that day with someone else and not in a classroom where 20-some other kids are trying to learn math or history or whatever they're on.
Okay, and I guess if I can have you answer that or give your comments, Commissioner, then I think we need to probably move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, members of the committee, that's a fantastic question. First off, what I heard you saying, in that you want to try and create an environment for innovation to occur. We concur with that assessment. We're trying to create an environment for innovation to occur and trying to have the school district share best practices and learn from one another. And we've heard from many of them that they appreciate the fact that we're trying to create that space for them. The second thing which you talked about is what's a suspension? And I don't think I was very clear for the committee, so I want to be crystal clear on this. When I was talking about that data, I'm talking about a student being out of school for the entire day. So the idea of a student being removed from the classroom for 15 or 20 minutes would not be a suspension, which would be reported to the Department of Education. And I'll even go further. If you're a general education student and you are told to go home after the third period of the day and you come back to school the next day, that's not a suspension which is reported by the Department of Education. So to that extent, we're really talking about a full lost academic day. And what I would also share with the committee is that there are a lot of parents that are talking about their students being segregated for 4 or 5 hours and not just having a 20-minute timeout conversation in the hallway, kind of being forgotten within their schools. Now, fortunately, that's not happening every day in all of our schools, but I will share with this committee, it is apparently happening enough that there are a lot of parents that have raised that concern with the department. And it's one that we take seriously and make sure that that's being addressed. To the 20-minute issue, we have toured various schools, met with them. We'd like to see, and we've appreciated the strategies in which they try to de-escalate situations by bringing a student out. As somebody who's officiated at a very high level with players much bigger than me on the field, there are sometimes you have to try and de-escalate situations, but you may get into a situation in which you have to tell somebody that's it for the day. What we heard from schools is that they're trying their very best to try and figure out how to strike that right balance. The numbers are saying that they're not striking it quite correctly, let's work together to figure it out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. I appreciate your indulgence.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, could you please repeat for me, because I also have not been a part of these discussions till now, but can you please repeat for me the statistics that you, Minnesota-specific statistics that you shared with us about suspensions for Minnesota children of color?
Commissioner. Mr. Chair, Representative. So what the department did is we took a look at 5 years' worth of data that had been submitted by schools to the Department of Education within DERS. And when we met with school districts in the late October, early November, the most recent year that had been submitted and which was public was 2015-2016. And looking at that data, African-American students comprise slightly more than 10% of the total populations of students in Minnesota public schools. But as it relates to the group of kids being suspended, they comprise 41% of all kids suspended in Minnesota. When you calculate out what that would mean in comparison to students that would identify as white, not of Hispanic origin, that would be of a function of 8 times to 1. When you take a look at the national data would be 3.5 to 1. For Native American students, the suspension rate in the state of Minnesota is 10 times to 1. And at national level, it's a discouraging number because it's 5 times to 1, but somehow we have managed to double that discouraging number.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, that is one of too many statistics about Minnesota and racial disparities, and from my perspective, an example of institutional or structural racism and bias that I think for Minnesota's future we have to contend with. And I heard Chair Anderson, I guess a couple of times in the course of this conversation, talk about her frustration with asking you for information and not getting what she wanted. As a rationale for the 30% cut to the budget, but it sure seems to me that those numbers that reflect the way that our children are being treated is a signal that we as policymakers have work to do, and by punishing the Department of Human Rights, we are actually punishing Minnesota children who are already, they're already experiencing what is an embarrassing disparity. And so I appreciate you being here at this late hour. I wish the parents that were here were able to testify. But this is exceptionally distressing, this deep cut. And it is in a bill that is, you know, full of a power grab from my perspective in the first place. And, you know, I don't like this bill very much, but this is stunning. And if we have an interest in our future and our kids, this can't stand. And I sure hope before this bill comes out of this committee, Chair Knobloch, that we rectify this, because this is not a good story coming out of the Minnesota legislature for the people of Minnesota.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner. Thank you for being available this late hour. You had mentioned the data and the disparities based off of race. How did the level of suspensions rate based on gender?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, members of the committee, we did not break it out by gender. We do know that there are some disparities. More students that are male are suspended than females.
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, what does that tell you?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, representative, members of the committee, I think what that tells me is that there are some issues concerning how some schools approach male students to female students, but the numbers of suspensions for the respective schools when we examined for race and disability, they were not the disparities between males and females were not as significant as what we were seeing for individuals with disabilities or with race. So there are some differences by male to female, but when you control for race, you don't see substantial disparities between men, or I'm sorry, male students and female students.
Mr. Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, my understanding was that male students were 9 times as likely to be suspended as female students. Is that not correct?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, when I said control for race, so just so we're very clear, the student that is most often suspended is an African-American male student. And the student that's also most likely to be suspended is a Native American male student. So if you're asking the question concerning trying to discern race from just gender, it is very difficult to ascertain that, because once you take a look at race as to who is suspended, it is typically students of color, and it is typically male students of color.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Garofalo.
Commissioner, I'm not disputing that, but correct me if I'm wrong, but doesn't the data show that white male students are suspended 9 times as often as white female students?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I do not believe that that is the case.
Okay.
Mr. Representative Garofalo.
Would it be possible to get this data? Would it take a lot of labor effort to get that data based on gender? If the information I've been given is incorrect, I want to know that. But my understanding and the data I've been given is that male students are far more likely to be suspended than female students, which would tell us that perhaps racism is not, we're looking at the wrong thing. There's several factors that are playing into this, especially if it's breaking down where it's consistent based on race. But if you could get that data, that would be helpful. And Commissioner, I would just say that there's no doubt in Minnesota that we have disparities. We have big-time disparities in gender, racial, geographic, and it's in education, employment, criminal justice. And the state of Minnesota and the taxpayers of Minnesota spend a lot of money trying to reduce those disparities. We spend a lot of money doing that. And it's clear that some of these programs are not working. Is part of the purview of the Department of Human Rights to identify programs that are not working in addressing the disparities problem?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, to your first point, I just want to be very clear that if you're talking about the suspension rate of all students, African Americans make up 41% of all the suspension. So when you start talking about male students to female students, you just have to appreciate that just at the very beginning of that analysis, that students of color represent more than half of the students that are being suspended year in and year out. It's close to 65 to 70%. So I appreciate what you're trying to do to entangle sort of the concept of gender with race. But if you're talking about the totality of students that are suspended, the profile of the student that's being suspended is a Native American or African American male student. To your question concerning, is it the jurisdiction statutorily for the Department of Human Rights to do an assessment concerning programs which are seeking to aid to address disparities? The Act calls upon us to investigate disparities, but there is no statutory obligation for us to do a full-fledged assessment of all the efforts which are being undertaken by the state.
Mr. Chairman, that's my final comment. I think,
Representative Garofalo,
again, we have a lot of money being spent by the taxpayers in the state to reduce disparities, a lot of it. And whenever we have examples of disparities, disparity programs not working, we are given one solution by the advocates of these programs, and that is that we're not spending enough money. Very rarely do we see changes in policy or the recommendation that programs be shut down and those dollars being prioritized. And I think of the Office of the Legislative Auditor model. I would like to see that somehow incorporated into the Department of Human Rights, where you could say, here's programs that taxpayers are spending money on to reduce geographic disparities or racial disparities. They're just not working. So a little bit off topic is my thoughts. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, then I'm going to recognize Representative Drazkowski, and then I think we need to move on to other witnesses. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner and Representative Anderson, for your good bill. Commissioner, you know, it sounds like I'm looking at your website here, and your quote says, school discipline is about teaching students what is expected of them and helping them find success, ensuring that a healthy learning environment exists and properly supporting teachers, not about punishing a student. And it sounds like, Commissioner, you're becoming a superintendent here. You know, we have, as Representative Garofalo was saying, we've got different, we've got schools and superintendents and school boards looking after discipline in their schools. We've got the Department of Education, and now we've got the Department of Human Rights. Can you tell us more how you got involved in this? It sounded, your description sounded like mission creep to me.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the quote that you read from the website actually came from the conversations we had with superintendents. So what I was saying within that quote is that I had heard superintendents, and within that quote, I was trying to honor the dialogue conversation that we had. I didn't come up with that language all by myself. That, again, was in that conversation with superintendents. Concerning the mission creep, it is clearly stated within the Human Rights Act, it's 363.813, about suspensions or expulsions of students, and if there is disparities there, that falls within the jurisdiction of the department. So I do not believe there's mission creep. To Representative Garofalo's offer concerning giving additional funding to the department to take a look at things, I appreciate that, but I hope that it comes with some money as well. Again, earlier tonight, there was testimony downstairs asking for the department to weigh in on sexual harassment. So, again, I say that there are issues for us to deal with, but we're trying to be intentional about it.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I it sounds like you guys have the ability to kind of go wherever you want, depending on somebody who complains about something. It seems pretty broad and wide open to me. I'd be more curious. I don't know a lot about the Department of Human Rights or your scope or your charge or what the statutes say. Certainly, Chair Anderson does and was asking you questions about it. Commissioner, why didn't you respond to the committee and Chair Anderson?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, to your question concerning the scope of the department, the jurisdiction set forth by this legislature, again, going back to Governor Lavender 50 years ago, was set forth very broadly. Public accommodations, public services, housing, employment, those are all contained within the Human Rights Act. So to this extent, if we think about it, to have a fully functioning democracy and ensure that civil rights are protected for all, the department would have to have broad rights to ensure that those rights are protected for individuals. To the extent that the information which was requested, I have shared two letters to Representative Anderson attempting to ask her, answer the questions that she has of the department concerning the investigation. I appreciate that there's additional information that she would like, but I am also bound by the Government Data Practices Act, and these are open files, and I'm not at liberty to provide all the information. She's asked for some information concerning how many individuals have worked on this respective endeavor. Once we close those files, I'm more than happy to provide all of that information.
Well, Mr. Chair and Commissioner, maybe we have found the answer. Maybe we need to look at what the role of the Department of Human Rights is and start to narrow that scope so that it has a better focus rather than one that seems to be wide open. I think Chair Anderson's bill attempts to maybe start to address that. And by the way, Chair Anderson, a great bill, one that starts to rein in some of not only this particular line item, but others as well. And I think if we look up and down our government, we spend so much in this huge government we have. We got to start to remove some of the redundancies. And thank you for your work, Chair Anderson.
All right. Commissioner, I want to thank you for your testimony, and I do want to say again to the parents here, people who are with Ed Allies, we've been talking about this topic for almost an hour, and it is a very important topic, and I do think that a lot of times hearing personal stories are really important, too. But I know that, or I am informed that there was testimony in Chair Anderson's State Government Finance Committee from some people on this. We have had a great deal of testimony and discussion right now with the commissioner on this. And I'm afraid that we have five other commissioners with departments to testify tonight, as well as another bill on our agenda. And so just given the late hour, I just feel like given the time we have spent with Commissioner Lindsay, it's appropriate now to move on. But I do thank you and do want to say that, you know, I certainly am concerned about this issue, and I appreciate being able to learn more about it. Thank you, Commissioner. And I think, Representative Hornstein, you just said you had a question for me?
For you, yeah. So I have a couple more questions on this topic, not necessarily for the commissioner, but to the author. Would you prefer that we just hold those till after the rest of the testimony, or just keep it on this topic? What would you prefer?
I think why don't we just keep it on. Why don't you ask those questions now, and then we can finish off this topic.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just noticed on page 6, lines 28 to 31, it states in the bill that the amount of the cut may not be used to reduce operations or services in the department's regional office in St. Cloud. And I sponsored back in March 2015 House File 1364, and that bill was successful. We were able to fund offices in Rochester, St. Cloud, and Duluth. And so I'm just wondering, Representative Anderson, why would you cut in Rochester and Duluth but not in St. Cloud?
Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hornstein, the St. Cloud office is the newest office. And so in order for that to be able to maintain and make progress in the issues that they're doing there, I felt that they needed to be able to be protected from any reductions that may occur.
Representative Hornstein.
Okay. Well, I think that this was really important for communities outside of the Twin Cities to have these offices, and I think they play a really important role. And so I'm concerned about that. And I guess just a very quick final comment and observation. You know, we've had some disturbing reports nationally. You know, the Anti-Defamation League has said that anti-Semitism is now up 60% incidents over last year. We have an increase of 15% of hate crimes and bias towards the Muslim community. Similar reports also for all people of color, immigrants, LGBTQ community. And just given what's happening in the country now, Mr. Chair and members, this seems like the last thing we should be doing now is cutting a human rights office that really is responsible for, you know, addressing so much, not only disparities, but these bias crimes that so many communities are feeling and so many communities feel fearful and have to address. There's something going on in the country now that I think is concerning. It's disturbing. And this needs to be this money, I think, needs to be restored somehow or the other. And I went, this last thing, Mr. Chair, during the break, I went to Memphis. There was the 50th anniversary of the killing of Dr. King, and it's interesting that this is also the 50th anniversary of the Department of Human Rights. A lot was going on in the country then, and on this topic. And you know, I was reflecting on how much progress we've made as a result of the work of the Civil Rights Movement and Dr. King. But yet, you know, it concerns me that when we take these steps backwards, and that's kind of what this feels to me. So I hope that we will really reconsider this cut. I'm again concerned about the regional offices, and I do appreciate, Mr. Chair, you were very helpful in that, as I recall, helping establish these offices in Rochester, St. Cloud, and Duluth. So I'm especially concerned about, you know, cutting those two offices, and as well as the entire 30% cut here. So as Representative Murphy said, let's reexamine this.
Mr. Chair, if I may, just for clarifying the record.
Commissioner.
Thank you. The department only has two offices. We have an office in St. Paul and then an office in St. Cloud. The governor asked for these regional offices. They weren't funded.
I see. Okay. Thank you. Well, let's fund those too, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
All right. Next, we have Deputy Commissioner Lee Ho from the Minnesota Department of Revenue.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pawlowski.
Mr. Chair, could I just have a point of order for a second? I'm looking at Rule 6.20, and I'm on page 27. A committee must not meet between midnight and 7 a.m. Is it your intention, then, that we would end at midnight if this continues?
Representative Pawlowski, it is my intention that we will be done by midnight, yes. We will not meet after midnight.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep. Mr. Ho, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for having me here today. I'm here to express the department's concerns about how House File 4016 will impact Minnesota taxpayers. As you know, the Minnesota income tax filing season ended last week. 2.9 million Minnesotans rely on the department to file their taxes securely and efficiently. House File 4016 will negatively affect our services to Minnesota taxpayers. As drafted, this bill reduces the Department of Revenue's general fund appropriation negotiated and enacted last year by $3.895 million. Additionally, there are reductions to other agencies' budgets that will indirectly affect the Department of Revenue. The reductions to the Department's budget and to other agency budgets will negatively affect our ability to maintain the current level of services we provide to Minnesotans, and will reduce the amount of money the department collects to fund vital state government programs. In his April 9th letter to Speaker Daut and Majority Leader Gazelka, Governor Dayton said he will not consider cuts to operating budgets of state agencies, which were negotiated and enacted last year. As a department, we plan our work around the resources allocated to us in our two-year biennial budget. We are well into the work plans we have created around our allocated resources. House File 4016 represents a 3% cut to our current general funds appropriated to the department. The bill also indicates that reductions must not be made to programs or services provided directly to the public. However, any cut to revenue will directly impact Minnesotans. The effective and efficient delivery of programs or services to the public describes essentially all the department's work. Our resources fund our customer outreach and education, and the tax administration system that serves all Minnesotans. The department cannot absorb the appropriation reduction and meet the requirements of the bill regarding maintenance of public services. The reduction in funds equates to a reduction of 47 employees who serve Minnesotans every day. This would negatively impact our ability to administer the state tax system. I'm going to highlight some of the specific concerns we have already identified with this bill. The hiring limitations in this bill will negatively affect our services. The provision preventing revenue from redeploying funding to meet our customers' ever-changing needs is an overreach into the management of the agency and will negatively impact Minnesotans. The department must have an ability to effectively manage customer service for all our customers, to include individuals, large and small businesses, our local government partners, and many more. To do this, we must consistently and effectively manage change that results from new technology and innovation here at the department and across a variety of industries that file and pay taxes in Minnesota. Shifts, for example, from paper filing to electronic filing reduce the need for some skills at the agency but increase the need for others. Another provision in the bill that is concerning is the pipeline valuation report. Last year, we reported that the scope and timeline specified in the bill will take additional resources. We produced a similar report approximately 10 years ago with the help of an outside expert, and it cost about $100,000. Today, we estimate $120,000 of additional resources to complete this work. We would like to work with you on the specifications of the report to ensure that it provides the information that can get us the best results. We are eager to serve Minnesota taxpayers as efficiently and effectively as possible. To do so, we need your help to secure the appropriate level of financial resources. Thank you.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. If we don't, if the governor doesn't sign, or if we don't pass and the governor doesn't sign the conformity bill, how much is that going to cost you? question one, and if we wait till January is somewhere saying we should do, how much will that cost you? Because then you have to figure it two ways, or maybe three or four.
Mr. Hope.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I believe in a recent letter to the State Gov Finance Committee on the prospect of nonconformity, we estimated approximately $7 million in cost of not passing any form of conformity bill. Now, in terms of the question of if we wait till January to pass it, that is not necessarily something that we've looked at closely. It will have an impact in the sense that we will not have as much time to prepare Minnesotans for the filing season and to prepare the forms necessary to make that happen.
Thank you, sir.
Other questions for Mr. Holt? Well, Mr. Holt, thank you for your testimony. Next, I have Commissioner Matt Mossman of the Department of Administration. Is Mr. Mossman here? There he is. All right. Commissioner Mossman, welcome back to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity to testify for the record. Matt Mossman, Commissioner of the State Department of Administration. Mr. Chair and members, Minnesotans expect that the Department of Administration continuously seek sensible process improvements and that we deploy innovative, user-friendly technology towards helping to ensure the efficient operations of Minnesota state government in areas such as procurement, construction management, continuous improvement, data practices, real estate, and other areas. Despite a state budget surplus and the need to strengthen centralized services like those at admin to help achieve long-term enterprise savings, the House State Government Finance Bill once again proposes to instead make drastic cuts to the Department of Administration. Doing so is counterproductive to making state government more efficient. For example, the bill revisits the elimination of a small three-person continuous improvement office whose sole mission and proven result is to help agencies deliver better, faster, more customer-focused results, and often at the same or lower cost. Similarly, the bill would undermine the ability of the State Historic Preservation Office to make the process, outreach, education, and digitization improvements intended by the legislature when the state government finance bill was passed by the legislature, transferring the State Historic Preservation Office functions to the Department of Administration just 10 months ago. Also, Mr. Chair and members, the bill proposes to move the duties of the State Data Practices Office from the Department of Administration to the Office of Administrative Hearings, even though most of the stakeholders report positive experiences with the Data Practices Office and no fundamental shortcomings have been brought forward. The move is unjustified, and with the addition of an unclassified director position, could politicize the office and increase the cost of government transparency. I join the Minnesota Newspaper Association, local government stakeholders, and Chief Judge Poost in opposing this proposal. House File 4016 proposes various information technology contracting changes as well. I oppose those changes and urge that Minnesota continue on the path of centralized IT services that it's on and that we build on the strengths that we have and increase funding for cybersecurity and for replacing outdated IT systems going forward. In addition, the bill fails to even fund the significant increase to costs for the Department of Administration that would result from the changes that are proposed in the bill as a result of us having to issue, negotiate, and oversee approximately 250 more RFPs and contracts annually. Those specified Department of Administration cuts alone amount to about $1.243 million, or 10.5% of the agency's operating budgets. However, those unwarranted cuts are potentially small relative to other unspecified agency budget cuts that could result or would result from House File 4016. Specifically, we also oppose the enterprise-wide cuts that would be made to offset the needed $9.5 million investment that has been made in the MNLARS program just a few weeks ago, and the implicit 3.5% budget impact that would result from requiring admin and other agencies to dedicate a portion of our IT budget to cybersecurity rather than funding the governor's recommendations for the needed increased investment in cybersecurity enterprise-wide. I also want to call your attention to some policy provisions that are problematic for the agency, including the rulemaking provisions that would slow down the department's ability to respond to the needs of business grantees and Minnesotans with a new bureaucratic process, and the blanket prohibition on the Attorney General's authority to prohibit contracting for legal services on a contingent fee basis. This change would significantly impact admin's ability to assert the state's subrogation rights against third parties and workers' compensation claims, which in the last 5 years has resulted in the recovery of over $2 million for state agencies. Perhaps most important, Mr. Chair and committee members, the bill is notable for what is not in it. The bill includes none of Governor Dayton's recommendations that would strengthen admin's ability to first, better care for state assets by reversing a 2004 accounting shift that redirects money away from needed asset preservation and puts it into the general fund as a budget balancing tool. Also, capitalizing on a small one-time revolving loan fund to implement water and energy efficiencies in state agency operations and then use the savings from those efficiencies to repay and resupplement the fund for future improvements. And finally, there are various other provisions that are not included in the bill, including those that would make it easier for small businesses to partner with the state in state procurement. In closing, Mr. Chair and members, the fundamental value of central service agencies is to drive better enterprise-wide outcomes and efficiencies through standardization, economies of scale, specialized skills, and best practices for common administrative functions. Admin's initiatives and innovations have been made possible with a combination of new funding and smarter use of base resources. However, none of them were the result of budget cuts or a seemingly random reduction in agency capacity. So, Mr. Chair and members, I would urge that the committee reject these budget cuts and instead fund Governor Dayton's recommendations, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, the other two commissioners happened to comment on the number of employees that are positions that would be lost. Do you happen to have a number for admin?
Commissioner Mossman.
Mr. Chair, I do not have the number off the top of my head, but I'm going to quickly speculate that it would be, I'm guessing it would be about 6 or 7 positions just going through the offices in my head.
Thank you.
Seeing no further questions, thank you, Commissioner Mossman. Next, we have up Commissioner Peterson with the Department of Labor and Industry. Commissioner Peterson, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members, I'll be brief. I have 2 points I want to make. That we are not, our budget is not come out, is not involved in this bill. But we have two specific policy issues, and I guess they are also financial issues. First of all is the required additional legislative review of rulemaking for residential building code changes that result in cost increase of $1,000 or more. We're concerned about that for three reasons. And first of all, most of the changes, the significant cost changes for all the enduring significant cost changes that have occurred have been either by the legislature or by Governor Pelini in 2009 when he made had to make an arrangement with the federal government to get funding for the recession, fighting recession, and so he agreed to have the energy code. The second reason we're opposed to it is that the real barriers to affordable housing are not building, it's not the building code. It's things like cost of land, labor, material, and land use regulation. It's nothing to do with the building code. The building code is not particularly significant cost of funding. I recognize at the same time that this is people back in this bill are very well-meaning. It's an important thing to do, to talk about. At the same time, I think it's just going to result in a lot of contentiousness, and it really won't result in the affordable housing that the backers want. Our second point, the second issue I want to raise, Mr. Chairman, is one that was just discussed by Commissioner Mossman, and that is the prohibiting the Attorney General from contracting for legal service on a contingent fee basis. We do that in our special compensation fund, which pays for all the two types of funding that goes to workers' comp victims, second injury fund and supplemental benefit fund, and also pays for the operations of the workers' comp fund. On the average, we make about on this thing we recover about $300,000 a year. Biggest one we've had in the last 10 years was the biggest year we had was $3 million. The lowest one we have is like $20,000 or $30,000. But the point of that is that's all money that goes into this fund and keeps us from having to raise, or keeps insurance companies from having to raise premiums on employers, work comp premiums on employers. So we're just concerned we're going to lose that money and we'll just have people have to pay more for these are fixed costs that the premium payers have to pay more. With that, concludes my testimony, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner Peterson. I don't see any questions. Thank you very much, sir. Next, we'll call on Commissioner Franz.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Paulson.
Mr. Chair, I would like to ask an overall question of the commissioner before he starts his testimony.
All right. Commissioner France, Representative Pawlowski's got a question for you before you get started.
Commissioner, in the past, you've been very frank with your assessment of what the governor would do with certain legislation if it crossed his desk. Commissioner, can you tell us in this bill and then perhaps if this is wrapped into a larger bill, what would happen if this bill and the condition that you see it here were sent to the governor's desk?
Commissioner France.
Mr. Chair, members, well, let's start this thing off right, okay?
you have to think about it.
No, there are a lot of problems in this bill. In fact, what I would he would really be hard-pressed to sign this because there are so many things. Just talking about the human rights cuts in and of itself is enough of a concern to the governor that I think right there he would not sign the bill, in addition to all the other fundamental questions. And if you so let me, if that's okay, let me jump into it if that's a good, okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pawlowski.
Mr. Chair, I raise the question because we're already beginning to see the early signs of stress on members and stress on staff and stress on the public. And I would hope rather than stressing everyone out that we would be working toward an accommodation with the governor. There are good things in these bills. We saw some good things today on the House floor. I would hope that we would be able to work toward the good things and make sure that they happen this session.
Thank you, Representative Pawlowski. Well, Commissioner France, welcome back to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. It's good to be back here. And thank you, Madam Chair, for the work you've done on this bill. But I do have to start off with this. We need to get serious about this bill. In its present form, there are fundamental concerns and problems that the governor has. One of the things I wanted to start off talking about before I talk about the particular problems I see from MMB's perspective is, as chief financial officer, the concerns I see in the overall House proposal that we really have in front of this committee. So, if you look at where we are right now, you know, we've just you've heard me say this many times, we've had 9 out of the last 10 forecasts have had a positive budget balance. We've got a $1.6 billion reserve. We have AAA we've been able to reestablish. So the question really is, how do we improve on our fiscal situation or our fiscal budget? And I see this bill and the House's budget position going the wrong way. We agreed on a budget last year, biennial budget last year, and the February forecast that we had on February 28th said that we have $329 million in this biennium and $251 million surplus in the next biennium. But in this session, we have no statutory or constitutional obligation to spend money. Rather, we have an opportunity to take that modest surplus and solve problems with it. There are many states that are not in this situation. There are a lot of states who have the same problems that we are facing, and they don't have the assets to fix them. We actually have $329 million this biennium and $251 million in the next biennium to solve problems that are solvable. There are multiple issues that we have all agreed that we need to work on. You look at the opioid crisis, the improving protections for the elderly, safer schools for our youth, early childhood learning, assessing or addressing sexual harassment in the workplace, fixing the vehicle registration system, passing a robust bonding bill to maintain our higher education buildings, our wonderful parks, our precious water, and our affordable housing, pension reform, and a tax bill that addresses the federal bill. Solving these problems are manageable within the $329 million that we have. We don't need to cut agencies to generate money, which this budget does. We don't need to take money from the state and reserve to fund these problems. And what we need to do is we need to be serious about budgeting within the $329 million. The governor's position, his budget, his supplemental budget position, was leaving he left $127 million on the bottom line and $399 million in the next biennium. And the House position spends every single dollar. The balance is zero. And, in fact, money is created by cutting agencies and taking money from the Stadium Reserve Fund. That is not a prescription for improving our fiscal situation. Let me go through some of the concerns that I have on the House budget proposal. If you look at the House targets, the targets spend every dollar of the $329 million, and the House spends in total, not just in this bill, the House spends in total another $58 million by cutting other agencies, and it spends $34 million by raiding the Stadium Fund and some other funds. That's $421 million in spending. The governor started with $329 million and left $127 million on the bottom line. If you look at the House tax bill, with all due reference to Chair Davids in front of me, the proposed tax bill in the House will create a hole in the budget in the future. Because the tax rate reductions are unaffordable now, it phases them in over several years. But they will not be fully phased in until 2021. That's the last year of our budget horizon. The cost of the tax rates grow from $130 million in the current biennium to over $570 million in the 2023 biennium. They're not going to be any more affordable then. We don't even know if our budget can sustain this level of a rate reduction going forward. Paying for these reductions also with one-time funding, which is what's happening in some of Chair David's tax bill, is also a risk, an additional risk to the revenue stream going forward. If you look at the dedication of sales taxes to transportation that was considered this morning in the transportation bill, the constitutional amendment being considered by the House legislature would have long-term consequences for the budget. Now, the current budget horizon only has a $22 million effect, but it would cost the general fund about $365 million in 2026-27 when it's fully implemented. If you look at the tax tails from 2017, just looking at the elimination of the inflation factor on the statewide property tax, that tax cut was only $10 million when it started, and now it grows to $188 million a year in a biennium in 2022 and 23. Costs over $1 billion in 10 years. If you look at the expiration of the provider tax, remember, in 2011, when it was decided that the provider tax would sunset, everyone that was in this legislature in 2011 also agreed that it would stay around until 2019. Well, the fact of the matter is, when you peel away the provider tax in 2019, that will show a $1 billion deficit in the health care access fund in 22 and 23. By allowing the provider tax to sunset, those expenses that have been shifted to the health care access fund will come back to the general fund. So if you take a look at the House tax bill and when it's fully phased in, if you look at the dedication of the sales tax transportation amendment, if you look at the repeal of the property tax inflator from last session and the expiration of the provider tax, that's foregoing over $2 billion in revenue just right there. We simply cannot afford to take these kinds of actions when we only have $329 million in this budget cycle to deal with and only $251 million in 20 and 21. We don't even know what the forecast will be for 22-23. So it should come as no surprise, as Representative has mentioned, the governor is concerned about all of these issues. He's concerned about the finance. He said over and over again that his number one priority is the fiscal stability of the state going forward. So we have got to leave some money on the bottom line at the end of the session. We've got to make sure that we leave money in the future biennial. You know, you've heard from a number of the other commissioners about the concerns that we need to not cut agencies. We have a budget in place. We need to not cut agencies to raise revenue. We need to take out the policy provisions that are in these budget bills. We need to quit rehashing old arguments, and we need to focus on those things that we know we can fix, the lists I just gave you a little while ago. So to the extent that this bill and the other bills that you're going to hear in Ways and Means get away from fixing problems that we can solve and instead putting a financial burden on our future, the governor's not going to be pleased with the bills that come to his desk. One of the things that House File 4016 does is, as Commissioner Mossman mentioned, it cuts the Department of Administration, and as Commissioner Deputy Commissioner Lee Ho mentioned, Minnesota Department of Revenue is cut, Minnesota Management and Budget is cut, the Department of Human Rights is cut. The governor simply finds these cuts to be nonsensical. When in fact the legislature are passing more laws with more responsibilities, more things for the agencies to do, the public expects us to be able to deliver. So unless you all start passing laws, removing responsibilities, removing programs, there's no justification for making these cuts. As I said, we've negotiated a balanced budget deal last year, and it's not something we're willing to do. The 30% budget cut to the Department of Human Rights is particularly troublesome to the governor, and he believes that is an attack on the human rights of all Minnesotans to reduce our efforts in this area. And I really support the parents that were here tonight on behalf of their children and their concerns and the work that Commissioner Lindsay is doing, and I hope that this committee will make some adjustments in that area. But I think the whole area of prioritizing agency resources is something that we do all the time in departments. As a department commissioner, one of the things you have to do is make sure you're fulfilling your mission. And the idea in making some of these central administration services cuts by cutting administration services but not services to the public, that's common sense doesn't even apply there. As a former business executive, I can tell you every business has central services. You cannot have a government or a private company operate without central services, and to suggest that you can cut those and not affect your bottom line to your customers or not affect your bottom line to the public, it simply just doesn't work. From my experience, if you can do that, then you know something that I don't know. The amount of micromanagement in this bill to the executive branch continues to concern us. One of the things, for example, we're prohibited from using salary savings from one part of the agency to another. So right now, if somebody in the Minnesota Department of Management and Budget decides to leave service, and it takes us a month or 2 months to replace that position, we've sort of, quote, saved the salary for a month or two. And this bill would prohibit me as a commissioner from using that money in any part of the agency other than where it came from. Well, part of my job is to decide, okay, do we need to replace that person right now, or is there somebody else in another part of the agency that we could use more help that we're under, we don't have enough support. That's what commissioners do. That's how you run an agency. That's what the executive branch does. So the extent to which this bill micromanages the executive branch, it makes it more difficult for us to try to be creative and save money. The specific issues I want to talk about for MMB deal with the Legislative Budget Office. We understand that transfer is going to occur, but we do not think that any funds from MMB should be transferred to pay for it. That was not the nature of the agreement, and the funds are transferred based upon the local notes that are being done currently by MMB. But of the 200,000 or so of that money, only about 20,000 relate to solely the local note aspect. And so taking the full $200,000 that's been appropriated for local notes simply is making a budget cut to MMB. We have strong concerns about the transfer, and what we want to do is to make sure that we provide all of the necessary expertise and control to the fiscal note process to the legislature by next January. And we have 6 months to do that. We think we can accomplish that, but it's going to take a lot of work. But we also have strong concerns about the data protections and the disclosure requirements of that office. The current fiscal note process is open to public inspection, so it's transparent. If someone asks for information, we give it, unless it's protected by some particular privacy concern from a particular agency. So we want to make sure that the Data Practices Act applies to the Legislative Budget Office, just like it applies to the fiscal note process that we currently are engaged in. The bill also transfers Results First, which is a new program that we've been working on for the last several years at MMB. It has a national reputation. It's designed to help us find programs that are proven effective through research and to make sure that information is given to policymakers, both the governor and the legislature, so we make sound decisions. So when we invest in new programs, we do it based on proven policy research. It's been, as I said, flagged as a national success, and we don't think that it should be transferred to the LBOs so that the LBO people have something to do in the summer. This is a full-time job, requires full-time attention, and we want to make sure it gets the attention that it deserves. The second issue I really want to talk about is something
before
that...
Before you get to that, Commissioner, can I... Representative Davis has a question. Representative Davis.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'll wait until the gentleman's finished.
Okay. Representative Wagenius?
Thank you.
Commissioner Franz is giving us a lot of information very quickly, and I want to be able to digest one of the bottom line things that you said, because everything else kind of feeds into that. So I want to go back when you said that if all of these budget adjustments and tax cuts go into effect in all of these budgets, then it will cost the state how much by what date? You gave that number, and I am trying to digest that number.
I gave a number of, Mr. Chair, Representative, of over $2 billion, and it phases in over time. It's not all at once. For example, the transportation of the dedication of sales tax for transportation doesn't take fully effect until 25, 26, I believe. And so some of those phase in over time.
Representative Guinness.
So if I'm, I just want to make sure I'm getting this straight. So this would be $2 billion a biennium by 2025? Or how, if I'm writing this down, how do I write it down?
What, Commissioner. Mr. Chair, Representative, what I'm saying is that when you add up all these different provisions, these are all biennial numbers, and the total biennial effect would be $2 billion a biennium, but not until 2025 and 26 for the transportation component. Some of them would take effect in 2021.
And how much would it be by 2021, do you know?
Well, the Chair David's tax bill would fully phase in of about $570 million by 2021.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And Chair Davis, since your name was mentioned.
Yeah, since I've got some things after the gentleman finishes, but what would it be by 2050?
Mr. Commissioner? Chair, Representative, it would be a whopping big number.
Representative Drazkowski, did you have a question?
I did, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, when you started off your discussion, I kind of wanted to know whether it's the government's money or the people's money. I won't really ask you that one. But last time we met, I asked you what the total tax increase was in the governor's budget, and my numbers had me at like $1.4 billion. You weren't really sure what the total was, but I'm sure you went back to the workshop between now and then. What is the total amount of the tax increase in the governor's budget?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Commissioner Bowley has testified to that, and I don't have that number in front of me. I'm sorry, but I don't have that number in front of me.
Commissioner, really? That's all I have, Mr. Chair. It's getting late.
It is getting late. Okay. Commissioner, I guess if you can wrap up, and then we'll take Representative David's question.
Mr. Chair, what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about the sexual harassment office, and I appreciate Chair Anderson's inclusion of this in her bill. I think we had some concern about the way it was structured. The governor was very serious when we did our study for sexual harassment activities and procedures in the state government. We wanted to make sure that we understood what was the nature of how we handled sexual harassment cases, how do we investigate, what were the responses. And the governor asked me to make a series of recommendations. And one of the recommendations that I made that he put into a supplemental budget was the creation of a central office. The central office would be in addition to what's going on with HR now. And so what the bill does is, in addition to creating a central office for sexual harassment and discrimination, it also adds all misconduct. The problem with adding all misconduct into this office is it pulls a lot of the claims and issues out of local agencies. Right now we have an HR department in each agency with affirmative action officers. That they need to be in those agencies. They do the hiring, they do the promotion, the training, and if there's a misconduct, they have to handle that. So that's where that is handled now. We did not want to centralize all of that into one office. What we wanted to do was to start off and make sure that we're doing sexual harassment cases properly. We're investigating them properly. We have the right kind of training for our investigators. One of the things we found was the level of the investigations was varied a lot. We didn't want that to happen anymore. So we want to have trained investigators. We wanted to add a place for people to file a sexual harassment claim in addition to the department where they can already file a claim with HR or with their supervisor. So the nature of the office as described in the bill is different than what the governor requested. And if we were going to expand the office to what the bill does, we would need a lot more money to do that, because we would essentially be creating one gigantic employment office, HR office. That was not our intent. Our intent was to be very focused, take the next step to make sure we deal with this issue that's really important right now, and that's sexual harassment. So we have some concerns about that. The third issue I wanted to talk about was the stadium reserve funds. Right now we have $27 million in the fund. And by the end of this biennium, we'll have, I think it's $40 million by the end of this, by the end of this fiscal year. So the proposal to take $30 million out immediately takes us down to about $10 million. We believe that the fund should be about $42 million at a minimum. So if we had $42 million in the fund on an ongoing basis, we think that is where we should have it. Now, that we will get to $40 million at the end of this fiscal year. All the projections show that the charitable gambling is going to continue to grow. But I don't think there's anyone that's more qualified to be cautious about recommending that what you do with the growing charitable gambling proceeds as I am. And I think one of the concerns we have is that we shouldn't be taking projected growth out of this fund until the money's actually there. So we won't get into over $40 million until fiscal 19. And then as that money grows, we're going to have to do something with that fund. We agree with that. We simply think now is not the right time, because there's only $27 million in the fund, $40 million at the end of this fiscal year, and we think it's premature to take the money out of that fund at this time. The other thing I wanted to mention was that the bill cuts $500,000 from the sexual harassment program if we don't realize that much savings from the gain-sharing program. Well, we've testified at length about the gain-sharing program and the fact that it's not ready to go yet. And even California, that has seven times the population of Minnesota, the most they've ever paid and the most savings they've ever had in 1 year is $70,000, not $500,000. So MMB is not expected to be able to get the program up and running and generate $500,000 by the end of the next fiscal year. So it's really a $500,000 cut to MMB. The other concern I wanted to mention was that the The bill reduces all agency budgets by $9.7 million to reimburse the Driver Vehicle Services Fund. You know, it was just on March 22nd that the legislature passed a appropriation to allow for the $9.7 million to be funded, and it was there were, at that time there was no requirement that any of this be funded by other agencies. Not only is that outside the agreement that we reached, it might be contrary to current law. An additional issue I wanted to mention was the limit of the governor's authority to support the work of his office by capping transfers from other agencies. This is micromanaging the executive branch and limits the flexibility and the responsiveness of the governor's office, whoever that might be in the next administration. The bill requires agencies to submit to report to the legislature when they submit to MMB an uncollectible debt of over $10,000. Well, that public information is already available to the legislature. All they have to do, all you have to do, is make a request. So the idea of requiring another report is just not necessary. The changes that the bill makes to the U.S. Stadium Authority is not supported by the current stakeholders. I'm not going to testify on their behalf, but none of them worked in terms of trying to make these changes. The Stadium Authority has made a lot of changes under the direction of Chair Michael Bekich, and we see no need for any changes at this time. And finally, the governor has said that any changes to the election and campaign finance law must have bipartisan support and must be in a separate bill other than in an omnibus bill. I have one update for Chair Detmer regarding the Fort Snelling provisions. This proposal is a really great proposal, and we think it will help support the preservation and development of the historic state asset and provide affordable housing, especially with the veterans' preference. We're pleased that the DNR has partnered with the developer to do that. We've reached out to you, and we have some technical changes we need in order to make that work, but we want to work with you on that project as much as we can to make that happen. But to go back to the original question, I think there's the pathway for this bill to be signed by the governor is not clear to me at this point, and I think what I want to do is certainly offer to meet and talk and work with you to make this bill acceptable to the governor, but at this point it's a long way from that.
Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Franz, well, here we go again. You had a lot to say tonight. Mm-hmm. Pretty exciting stuff. You know, I'm carrying the governor's bill, and I'm carrying that bill, and that's the omnibus tax bill. You know, sometimes when you carry things around here, you just go back to Kelly and take a shower, use some Pantene Pro-V and some Zest for Men, and you're good to go. This was a tough one on this massive tax increases of the governor. I took three showers in a row and still had to think about it. $1.4 billion in tax increases, and you only leave $127 million on the bottom line. That's problematic. Massive regressive tax increases in my bill. Spending, you know, you mentioned spending. They were spending all this money as Republicans. Our spending is a little different than your spending. Our spending is giving it back to the people that overpaid is what our spending is. We give it back to the people. Now, one concern in my bill is, I guess it's in HHS, we reinstate the sick tax. And I always think of that of a farmer in Fillmore County was picking corn, and he put his arm in the corn picker because there's some corn stalks in there, got stuck, and he lost his arm. The thing engaged, and he lost his arm. So we'll send him to the hospital, $300,000, and, oh, by the way, we're going to tax you for it, too. And that's just not very Minnesota nice. I don't see that one coming back to taxing sick people. But, you know, Commissioner, a lot of rhetoric tonight, getting late. When you and I first met, we had a $6.2 billion problem. And you and I and former Assistant Mossman did a great job to get us out of that hole. We did it. So you and I solved a $6.2 billion shortfall. I'm not too worried about you and I being able to figure out a $329 million surplus. Now, this is something we can do. You're really good at what you do. You got some good folks around you, and we can do this. So when you're ready to calm down, lower the rhetoric just a bit. I love you dearly. You know that. But if you can just tone it down a little bit, have the governor tone it down a little bit, you'll notice I've been very toned down. I'm not saying, I don't go to the press and say anything other than we got to do it, we can do it, let's go. Give me a call. You got my phone number. When you're ready to talk serious about serious things, we can get this done. And you know, I think I've aptly named the tax bill for this year. You know, the $6.2 billion solving that problem, that was a smoking hot tax bill, 2011, okay? If we don't work together and get this done, then the name of my tax bill kicks in. It ain't my fault. So just consider that. Give me a call when you're ready.
Okay, I'm going to take Representative Druskowski and Mark Hort, and then we're going to move on to the next witness, Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just quickly, Commissioner, Mr. Marks was kind enough to give me the numbers of the tax increases in the governor's budget in fiscal 18 and 19, and Mr. Marks has got them broken out here. But the total for 18-19, $20.4 million. The 2020 to 2021 number is $1.416 billion tax increase that the governor is proposing. So, Commissioner, I wonder, has the governor backed off of that terrible idea at this point?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think the key for the governor is making sure that over 2 million Minnesotans get a tax refund through his tax credit program. One of the things he wanted to do was to make sure that the benefits that were felt by the businesses at the federal level, that's great for businesses and the federal tax benefits that they got. But one of the things that he wanted to make sure was that Minnesotans, average Minnesotans, middle, lower income Minnesotans got tax credits and tax refunds in Minnesota. So his number one priority were individuals in Minnesota, and that's why he wanted to have his tax credit to provide that. The other issue that you, the number that you throw in there regarding the provider tax, is something that is a current law, and so it's not an increase. It doesn't go away if we extend it in 2019. But the key there is that how are you going to replace that money and the money we spend in healthcare related costs in the healthcare access fund if that's not there? So I'd ask you, what is your solution to solving that $1 billion deficit problem that we're going to have in 2022-23?
Okay, I'll take that as a rhetorical question.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you. Well, Mr. Chair, Commissioner, what is, under current law, what is the provider tax expected to generate in fiscal year 2022?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't have the number for 2022. I mean, obviously, if it expires in 2019, it will not generate any money in 2021 or 2022, and what will happen, the reserve that's in the health care access fund will run out by the end of, I think, 2022.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. So, Commissioner, in 2022, current law provides at zero, so the $999 million tax increase to health care access fund through the provider tax the governor is bringing is a $1 billion component of that tax increase. And by the way, Commissioner, I've got the cheat sheet on the governor's honking tax increase here on the backs of the poorest of Minnesotans ready here and waiting for you, and I'll give it to you so you've got it next time we talk. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mark Hort.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just be short because we tend to get
nice.
Yes, we tend to get confused talking budget and tax bill, but let me just emphasize the governor's tax bill that was presented and heard before the tax committee and so forth provides cuts for 80% of, according to the incident report, 80% of Minnesota taxpayers from $121,000 down. It's very progressive. So I could go more, but just the tax bill, we tend to mix everything together and use other numbers, but the tax bill provides cuts.
With that, thank you, Commissioner Franz.
You want me to leave, Mr. Chair? That I can take a hint. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Finally, we have Commissioner Clyborn, if she could come forward. Commissioner Clyborn, welcome back to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Good Good evening, Mr. Chair, members. For the record, my name is Joanna Clyborn. I'm the Commissioner of Minnesota Information Technology Services, and I'm here to testify on House File 4016. This bill contains several problematic provisions that would have a debilitating effect on the executive's branch to effectively operate within the realm of information technology. First, this bill would require all IT enterprise software projects to be carried out by an external vendor unless the legislature specifically appropriated money for an internal project. While on the face this may appear workable, if one believes that the legislature specifically appropriates dollars for IT projects, however, that's not truly entirely the case. The vast majority of IT projects are funded through generally appropriated agency operating and program budgets. So to give you a sense of the scope in 2017, 270 IT projects were initiated within the executive branch, most of them related to software applications. These projects range in size from and duration, some lasting a couple of weeks while others cover several years. It's unreasonable to expect that state agencies to determine during the legislative session every IT project that will be initiated during the biennium that follows. But that's exactly what would be necessary. In order for the legislature to specify appropriations for hundreds of IT projects. And not only that, but to delineate what should be done in-house, what should be done through a vendor contract. And setting aside all incredible logistical challenges that that would raise and the impediments to it, members should also consider whether it's appropriate for the legislature to determine in law which of the hundreds IT projects should be done internally and which should be outsourced. MIN already works with agencies to do what is called a build or buy analysis when we're looking at new enterprise software applications being considered. So for any IT project, we work with the agency, we weigh the costs and benefits of having to do the work by either state staff, the contractors bringing them in-house. Is it wholly outsourced? Is there a commercial off-the-shelf product that we could use that makes sense or something that could be slightly modified? All this requiring of application IT projects to be done through vendor contract would have to be changed. And so unless the legislature is directed otherwise, there is no in-house analysis. It is pretty much all going out-house. It strips all flexibility to the agency leaders to craft the appropriate approach. And I often hear that government should run like a business. So I think it's important to note the private sector companies of the size and scope of the state government, similarly sized to the mix of internal staff and contractors and vendors, they basically utilize a scope, right? They mix it up. They don't automatically say everything goes out of house. They take a look at it each project by project. It is really hard for me to imagine a scenario in which a private company would tie its hands in the spring of one year as somehow setting in stone how the IT project work should occur for the 2 years following that. It makes no sense to put it in time and money, energy that is expended, to issue the request for proposals, to find the vendor resources who are capable of doing the project work, especially when you take in the fact that we've got 20 or 30-year-old legacy systems. When we have minute staff who can look at those systems, who've been working on these systems, and some of these folks have been working on these systems since they were first conceived and put into place. So in end, what will happen is we'll wind up paying vendors or contractors for months of work simply to make them familiar with the systems and capable of doing the work that we have already within our existing inventory. And frankly, that would be an incredibly poor use of tax dollars. Now, it is understandable, however, and appropriate for the legislature, I think, to put guardrails around the delivery of IT. It's reasonable to expect the executive branch to first look at commercially available software before opting to develop new software systems. But this legislation really goes past setting those guardrails around IT. Instead, what it really does is it erects roadblocks for state agencies who are looking for the most cost-effective method of completing an IT project in a timely manner. So I would really ask for your reconsideration on this provision. And then secondly, I want to relay my concerns in regards to cutting other agencies' budgets. And I know the governor has expressed his strong opposition to this. In order to fund the MNLAR's work and the additional work that is needed,
As the governor has made very clear, those agencies and Minnesotans, they deserve better. They should not be punished for the IT shortcomings that they had absolutely nothing to do with. Rewaging settled disputes over sources of already appropriated dollars is a distraction, frankly, of the important work that needs to continue within MNLARS. Work that is necessary to make the system work and what it needs to be for the deputy registrars and other stakeholders. And lastly, I want to relay my concerns with the unfunded mandate for the bill, which would require agencies to spend at least 3.5% of their IT budgets on cybersecurity. While I appreciate the recognition in the greater investment of cybersecurity, and it is certainly needed, I'm concerned that with no new funding being provided for cybersecurity, what it really does is affects an IT budget cut that exasperates the already existing IT challenges that we're facing in our state. It will, I believe, result ultimately in the delay of system modernization projects, reduce the investment in applications and maintenance support, or frankly just delay the replacement of hardware failures and systems outages, which we'll see the increase of as a result of not replacing some of the outdated equipment. I urge the committee to relook at this and to consider the governor's funding request for the cybersecurity piece, which would provide $19.7 million in new funding for cybersecurity in this biennium. It's the right move that we need to make for our state. It's an area that we've been neglecting, and it's about time that we look at how do we manage, frankly, this threat to our state resources. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have, members.
Thank you, Commissioner Clyburn.
Wow. Thank you.
Members, at this time what I'm going to do is, what we're going to do is I'm going to temporarily lay over the bill. We can have discussion to the bill and we take up the amendment to put it on to the vehicle bill in the morning. House Bill 4016 as amended is temporarily laid over. We have a number of people who have waited here a long time this evening. I want to be able to give them the courtesy of being able to testify so they don't wait here all evening for nothing. So at this time, we're going to take up the environment bill. Representative Fabian. Representative Fabian moves that House Bill 3502 be referred to the General Register. And there are a few amendments. First of all, the chair will move the A24 amendment. This is a technical amendment which ensures that appropriations aren't somehow double counted and spent twice. Is there any discussion to the A24 amendment? I see no discussion. All in favor of the A24 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A24 amendment is adopted. Second, we have the A18-0843 amendment. Representative Fabian moves the A18-0843 amendment, which provides for up to $7,000 for redesigning the printed and digital versions of the fishing regulations and hunting and trapping regulations, and you can read the rest of the amendment. Any questions on the A18-0843 amendment? Seeing no questions, all in favor of the A18-0843 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A18-0843 amendment is adopted. Next, Representative Fabian moves the A18 amendment. Representative Fabian, can you speak to the A18 amendment?
Mr. Chair, thank you. This is related to the 3M settlement, and what we're doing here is a technical. There's some technical things involved here in the creation of the natural resources damages account that's being established in the remediation fund. And it spells out in here in section or subdivision 2, the revenues from actions taken by the Attorney General on behalf of the Commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency and the Commissioner of Natural Resources under section so forth and so on. This has to do with the settlement, and it's really quite technical. I've got Brad Hagemeyer here. I'd really like him to go through this just to make sure that everybody understands it, if we could do that very quickly, Mr. Chair.
Very quickly, Mr. Yep. Chair. Mr. Hagemeyer, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, I'm Brad Hagemeyer with the House Fiscal Analysis Department. The A18 amendment is what you're on currently, I believe, right?
Yep.
Okay. This creates a natural resources damage account. It's a account similar to the 3M account. This isn't the 3M account directly. It's the same area of statute that that's created in. There's four dedicated appropriations, basically, or accounts in the remediation fund. After the 3M account is created, three of them are created in the statute. This one just hasn't been created, so it's the language to create the fourth account, so they're all in statute in the same area of law.
And Mr. Chair, this is intended to add some clarity to the remediation fund.
Representative Hillsborough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the author of the bill, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, it's late. Is there anything about the identification of this fund or the creation of the fund that actually puts any limits on what the funds can be used for?
Chair Fabian.
Mr. Chair, I think that we're addressing that in the next amendment. I don't believe, again, it's this is the technical, Mr. Hagemeyer.
Mr. Chair, so the other amendment relates to a 3M account. This one has some language in statute already. It's basically how they currently operate. There's just currently a dedicated appropriation. It's mostly monies from settlement agreements or various natural resource damages that have been caused that were paid back to the state by whoever is causing those. The agency just treats it as a dedicated appropriation within the remediation fund. They have statutory authority over it to spend it now. So this just puts it into statute so we can see it better in statute and point to it. And this language has been run by the PCA and DNR, and they both were fine with it.
Okay. Okay.
All right. See no further discussion. All in favor of the A18 amendment, signal by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The A18 amendment is adopted. Finally, we have the A-19 amendment. Representative Fabian moves the A-19 amendment. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the A-19 is some additional side rails on the 3M settlement money designed to ensure that the money is spent according to the terms of the settlement, and then also contains provisions to allow the money to be invested at the State Board of Investment.
Representative Guinness.
Mr. Chair, members, this is more than side rails. This is a fundamental change in the agreement. I'm going to ask for a roll call on this. What this language does is change the priorities of the settlement agreement, and it does it in two ways. One, it says that the legislature is establishing priorities rather than in the settlement agreement, it is the AG, the PCA, and DNR. So if you look in the definition section of the settlement agreement, the definition of state is those three entities I just mentioned. So instead of having the state make the decision, that is those three entities, the legislature on line 1.16 sets the priorities and in doing so picks up some of the language of the settlement agreement, but not the priorities of the settlement agreement. The settlement agreement has three priorities, and within the first priority has a number of options for the state, that is the AG, the PCA, and the DNR, to pick from, and says not limited. These are just options, but it's not limited. In addition, on line 2.10, there are limitations on the percent of money that in the account that can be spent in local and state and local administrative expenses, and not more than 10% may be spent on studies. That is not in the settlement agreement. It's just not there. And then there is in the lines at the end where it talks about recommendations, solicit recommendations from each of the cities. It lists the cities, but in the settlement agreement it says not limited, including those cities, but not limited to, and this agreement puts a limited on. So this is a fundamental change in the settlement agreement. Members, we have separation of powers. So I pulled out what our Constitution says about separation of powers. and it said no person or persons belonging to or constituting one of these departments, that is our three departments, shall exercise any of the powers properly belonging to either of the others except in instances expressly provided in this Constitution. And if you look at the Constitution, it does not allow the legislature to intervene in a court settlement. So that's why I'm asking for a roll call. This is way out of line.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you. Mr. Fitton, were you done?
Well, the only other thing I would say, if we did this, we're just procrastinating or maybe not getting the money. It's just like saying, oh, well, we really didn't need it. This is a lot of money to put in jeopardy. And it's beyond jeopardy.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I actually do believe that this amendment violates the court order. I believe that it could put the settlement in jeopardy. And, Mr. Chair, I would urge members to vote no on this provision.
Chairman Fabian, comments to this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've worked with Representative Fenton and so forth to get this language drafted. You know, I feel it's appropriate for us to try to put some guardrails on how much money can be spent for administrative costs and so forth. We've expressed concern from the very beginning that there was no limits on the amount of administrative costs that the agencies could charge back to the accounts, and we feel that that's important that we be able to do that kind of stuff. We want to make sure that the cities and the areas that are involved in this are the cities and the areas that get the money, not someplace up in Roseau County or something like that. So that's why we're naming the things that are here.
Representative Hillstrom.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, with all due respect, Representative Fenton, isn't a lawyer, did you actually discuss it with the Attorney General's office to see if this would put the money at risk? Or how about the departments that actually have to administer this that reached the agreement with 3M?
Representative Fabian.
Mr. Chair, I did not, discussion with Representative Fenton or the Attorney General's office. I talked to Representative Fenton shortly this afternoon.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Fabian, thanks for bringing this amendment forward. I would urge members to adopt it. A reminder of members, these are public funds, settlement agreement. These are not private funds. They're not sitting in a 3M trust. Remember that Chairman Knobloch wisely reviewed the settlement agreement, and actually as part of the settlement, at that time, they were proposing to put the funds in a fund that did not exist in the state of Minnesota. So, Representative Fabian, this illusion that somehow public funds can just get appropriated and spent by the executive branch without legislative oversight is it's kind of comical. I would hope that if everything was reversed and there was a Republican governor and a DFL legislature, we wouldn't see the roles reversed. I would hope this side of the aisle would see the wisdom of making sure that we don't have a runaway executive agency spending public funds the way they want. Thank you for bringing this forward, and I would urge everyone to vote yes.
The clerk will take the roll on the bill, on the A-19 amendment.
Representative Knobloch.
Yes.
Representative Vogel.
Yes.
Representative Carlson.
No.
Representative Anderson.
Yes.
Representative Baker.
Yes.
Representative Davids.
Yes.
Representative Dean.
Yep.
Representative Detmer.
Yes.
Representative Druskowski.
Yes.
Representative Fabian.
Yes.
Representative Garofalo.
Yes.
Representative Gunther, Representative Hamilton, Representative Hausman,
no.
Representative Hertas,
yes.
Representative Hillstrom,
no.
Representative Pornstein,
no.
Representative Liebling,
no.
Representative Loon,
yes.
Representative Marquardt,
yes.
Representative Murphy,
no.
Representative Nornes,
yes.
Representative Pulowski.
Yes.
Representative Poppy.
No.
Representative Torkelson.
Yes.
Representative Erdahl.
Yes.
Representative Wagenius.
No.
There being 17 ayes and 8 nays, the A-19 amendment is adopted. All right, we have two witnesses to testify. If DNR Assistant Commissioner Bob Meyer could come forward. Commissioner Meyer, welcome to the Committee on Waste.
Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. Commissioner Landwehr expresses his regards for not being able to be here today. I will do my best to keep my comments as brief as possible. We have been working with Representative Fabian and the committee over the session to try to address our concerns dealing with policy and budget, and we are grateful for the money that we have received in the bill dealing with chronic wasting disease. However, the governor's request was for $1.5 million. There's currently $750,000 in the bill for chronic wasting disease response. This will force the deer hunters to probably or to pay the remainder. What we're estimating is to be $1.4 million for this fiscal year in dealing with this response or this disease and our surveillance costs. The bill additionally doesn't have any money for our forest inventory requests. As you may have seen, our sustainable timber harvest analysis was done this year, and one of the big findings was that we don't have enough data on the types of trees or the amount of trees we have in our forest, so we're asking for $1 million in that. The bill, in addition, also appropriates puts into place in statute a 60%, 40% split on all of our snowmobile account revenues. We're currently working with Minnesota United Snowmobile Association on a memorandum of understanding. However, we've been over-appropriating that account by about $1 million a year. So if we're going to go down this specific split in statute, we would request that that account be appropriated to the actual money that's in the account, not what we're forecasting that based on snow or no snow. So we'd need to adjust that. There's also language that the amendment that was adopted dealing with the voter registration system. We are concerned, we support the concept, but we're concerned about the over-prescriptive language that may cause instability in our online license sales system. I know everybody's been very critical about online registration and sales systems this session. I don't want the DNR to be forced into a situation to have our system placed in instability. The language in the bill says we have to put a link to the Secretary of State's office on the last page before you print your license. We're afraid by forcing a person to go out of our website to the Secretary of State's office and then come back that they may not be able to come back or not understand how that goes. So we want to work with the author on how to resolve that. If we have the flexibility to work like we did with LifeSource to become an organ donor on our online sales system and use our flexibility with our vendors and other professionals, we can work through that. There are a number of policy items in the bill that are ours, and we appreciate that. There are, however, other policy in the bill that we do not support. And as we all know, the governor is concerned about the amount of policy that will be in these bills. Mr. Chairman, the Hayes Lake State Park All-Terrain Vehicle Pilot Project, transferring water use permits and irrigation test well payments and management plans in Article 2, any language that moves us towards Western state water law is very concerning for us, and it should be for any person who has farmers in your district. This would place one landowner against the other in water rights issues, so we do not want to get close to that. The Sand Dunes State Forest moratorium extension, we're concerned about that, and the inability to implement the recently approved management plan. Clearwater County access action to obtain prohibited action to obtain access prohibited. We are concerned about continuing that, and I was just talking to the representatives in the area last night about resolutions to that. And finally, there's language in the bill that would mandate that EQB use a good faith rule making exemption on recreational trails. We've attempted that once before, and the ALJ denied that request because of vague and ambiguity within the actual language we were looking for. We've submitted some suggested language. If that's going to move forward, we need to make sure that that language is correct and we define all terms as that moves forward, Mr. Chairman. So with that, I can stand for any questions, and that's just an abbreviated concern list. We will be sending a letter to the chairman of the legislature here shortly.
Well, thank you, Mr. Meyer. Any questions for Mr. Meyer? Thank you, Mr. Meyer.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Commissioner Stein. Commissioner Stein, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is John Link Stein, Commissioner of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. We did send a letter today, and I I'll supplement my comments in addition to the letter on the A-19 amendment, which was just previously acted on by the committee. I want to thank the chairman, committee chair Fabian, for his willingness to discuss the issues relating to the bill. We've had two small technical provisions that the governor requested that are policy that have been included in this bill. We appreciate that. However, we do have a concern about new mandated spending of $199,000 in fiscal 19 and $184,000 that would follow every fiscal year thereafter from the environmental fund that does not provide the fee revenue to cover that cost. And we believe that that cost, which is for a voluntary de-icer application certification program, would more appropriately come from the general fund, and urge the committee to consider changing it from the environmental fund to the general fund. I would like to comment on several policy provisions in the bill that give us reason to oppose it. First, on the wild rice provisions in Section 94 and Sections 110 through 117, I support continued work to protect wild rice in the state of Minnesota, and this bill and its results would create greater regulatory uncertainty for our communities and for the people across the state about the water quality standards that would apply to a known contaminant that impacts wild rice, sulfate, and discharges from regulated municipalities and businesses. We think that it could create unintended litigation risk, as well as another concern is the language that would result in changes to our irrigation water quality standards, which is short-circuiting work that we're already providing a rulemaking for, and that would result in lessened availability for water for agricultural irrigation in the future. On our water fees, there's provisions in Sections 56, 60, 61, and 62, and Section 78, which prohibit the agency from adjusting our fees without legislative approval. And the legislature does have significant and sufficient opportunity already for oversight of the agency's fees, and we think that this is one place where that always happens, and we've had no real proposal before us yet. We're taking input from an advisory committee at this time, and there is no active proposal to change fees at the present. Our next concern is with the de-icer certification and applicator certification program in Section 83, which creates a very broad immunity for businesses and homeowners who use commercial applicators to apply de-icers if those applicators have been certified. And because of the way the commercial applicator is defined in the bill, an individual or company and its employees that apply for de-icer for hire is what is defined as a commercial applicator. And this immunity language then would actually create a disincentive for private firms to train more than one of their employees. And what might happen is that a company would be certified, but the actual person applying the de-icers would not be sufficiently trained. So we think that that language needs to be adjusted and corrected. We also think that there's a concern over the fee cap of $250 for a half-day training session. It might result in fewer training sessions being offered statewide. And this is a critical issue for us as salts and chloride in our waters is a growing and present concern across the state. On construction and demolition landfills, we have a concern on Section 108, which adds additional requirements to the permitting process for construction and demolition landfills. And many of those landfills across our state are finding contamination in groundwater at levels that require the agency to act because they exceed some level of health risk identified by the Minnesota Department of Health. We oppose this section because it does not address the drinking water threat and the underlying groundwater contamination. We would prefer to work with the author and develop language that could be more acceptable. Wastewater effluent limitations for industrial permits in Section 66 of the bill is also one concern that we have. Last year, language very similar to this was introduced, and the agency was neutral on the 2017 language because it applied to regulatory certainty only for municipalities, and we supported the passage of that bill. Section 66 now expands that to industrial private facilities, and we do not support that. Regarding the A19 amendment, and lastly, I'll say, Mr. Chair, and then stand for questions, regarding the 3M settlement, much of the comments that were made do give us reason for concern. The language that was amended to the bill, we did not have a chance to review. We believe that it is a concern that will bring us back to the judge that approved the settlement. We believe that it puts the agency and the Department of Natural Resources in a condition in which the terms of the settlement have been modified. And if that's the fact, then we're not going to have a settlement. We won't have action under it. And so before we've even met with the communities, before we've even sat down and laid out a list of priorities, we can't fulfill the agreement, and we oppose it. So, Mr. Chair, with that, I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Commissioner Stein. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with all of your concerns. I share them. I just was hoping you could clarify, this seems like a new story just breaking today, concerning the agency in wild rice. And I just saw this article in the Star Tribune, MPCA hits dead end on effort to protect wild rice. Could you lay out exactly what this development means and any impacts on the bill or things moving forward?
Commissioner Stein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hornstein.
Just if I may, Mr. Chair, I had a conversation. I had a conversation with Commissioner Stein this morning. He was nice enough, his office, to give me a call and give me a heads up on the announcement that they were going to make, and I appreciated that, and I appreciate what's going on.
Okay, Commissioner Stein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, and Chair Fabian. The feedback on the wild rice rule that we received and the administrative law judge's report, as well as testimony we received across the state in hearings and in public meetings, leaves me with the conclusion that the science of our rule, the understanding that we have about how sulfate impacts wild rice, is accurate. It's reliable. It's peer-reviewed science. It's been published in journals and relied upon internationally already. The science, though, is only one component of developing a new water quality standard. The second component is how that standard will be implemented. And that was the challenge that we heard the loudest and clearest level of concern from municipalities and from the communities around the state that were unclear. And the law judge was very strident of the agency's approach on how we would implement the standard, how we would find affordable and rational ways to implement that standard were the reason that I decided to pull it back rather than move it forward at this time. We favor working on solutions that will be affordable and implementable to protect wild rice going forward. I also need to stress that wild rice grows in very many places across the state of Minnesota, from the southeast corner of the state through the central lakes region all the way to the Arrowhead District. We have healthy, growing stands of wild rice that need to be protected, and that's the purpose of our Water Quality Standard, is to act proactively to protect it. I am concerned when we get the kind of feedback we got from the administrative law judge about the impacts of our regulation on placing burdens on communities for their wastewater treatment facilities, that we did not present a compelling enough implementation strategy. And I want to work with the legislature and the representatives that are interested in reaching a solution on that subject.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you for that. But the concerns that you raised in your letter dated today about the wild rice provisions in this bill, those still stand?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Hornstein. The regulatory uncertainty challenge that we face is there are water quality standards that have been approved in permits already for wild rice. The conundrum that's going to exist if this bill were to become law is that nothing would be in place, and it would be a field day for litigation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, the standard that's in place currently is 10 milligrams per liter, and that was put in place in 1973. It was based on field observations from the 30s and 40s. I think that the administrative law judge, what I read, and I'm not an attorney, and I don't want to be, but I don't know that the science is settled, as Commissioner Stein says. I respectfully disagree with him on that. The reality is that the 10 milligrams per liter, and Commissioner Stein can confirm this, has never been written into a permit since 1973 until the U.S. Steel permit. It was written in last year sometime. Okay? And it's never been enforced. Never been enforced. So the idea, and he just says we have abundant wild rice growing around the state. We are interested, I'm interested in putting some things in place that are going to help us improve wild rice stands. We all want abundant wild rice. But the 10 milligram per liter is doing absolutely nothing. From my perspective, it's never protected one grain of wild rice. We have the standard there. It's a numeric standard. But it's not being written into permits, and it's not being enforced. So I appreciate that the commissioner has recognized that we need to go back and to the drawing board almost and start and take the recommendation, not the recommendation, the ruling of the administrative law judge and get this problem solved. Excuse me.
Mr. Chair. Commissioner.
Thank you. Just briefly, I know it's the hour's late. There is a permit that was issued by the agency in 2013 for U.S. Steel. The provision protecting wild rice was set at 10 micrograms per liter for sulfate discharge. The science, we believe, is more clear than Representative Fabian, and reasonable people and reasonable scientists will disagree, as do reasonable engineers and reasonable financial planners frequently disagree. I'm not opposed to disagreement, but what I am opposed to is placing additional regulatory uncertainty around this, where we would wind up with potential issues at the federal level with the oversight that we have with EPA. Having a standard in place, if we were to eliminate a standard under the Clean Water Act, that's a reportable action to the U.S. EPA. We are required to advise them that we're eliminating a standard. If the legislature or a law eliminates a standard, we will notify the EPA that a standard has been eliminated. And if that occurs, that is the situation in which we're begging for a judge to tell us something otherwise. And I do not favor that solution, Mr. Chair. I favor a solution where we come to some more harmonious resolution and take the time to do it without this legislation.
See no further questions. Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sorry, Representative Davids.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm just very excited that when Commissioner Stein said that he appreciated Chair Fabian put policy in this finance bill, I can see in the tax bill, there's going to be a lot of policy in the tax finance bill. So I'm just very excited the governor's coming around that there can be some policy in the finance bills.
Okay. All right. Discussion of the bill is amended. Representative Fabian, last comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know it's late. The big thing in here for us is the CWD testing that Commissioner Myers gone through that. There's a whole bunch of other stuff we could do, but I'll do that another time. Thank you.